You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
But the thing is that to enforce an imperial agenda, you scrap the republic. Now, Julius Caesar understood that perfectly well. I can't remember the exact quote, but he said, you don't build an empire with a republic. And I think that, in effect, what's happening is that the republic is being scrapped. It's not only being scrapped in France, it's being scrapped in America.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michelle Chosadovsky. Today's show, State Terrorism, Franco-American Style. Michelle Chosadovsky is an economist and is the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. He is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. Today we discuss his most recent articles on the alleged ISIS terror in Paris, as well as the Radisson Hotel terror in Bamako, Mali, a former French colony. We analyze current state-sponsored terror in general within a larger global geopolitical and economic framework. Michelle Chosadovsky, welcome.
I'm delighted to be on Guns and Butter.
On November 13th, 2015, shootings and suicide bombings were staged in five different locales in Paris, the capital of France. 130 people were killed. Less than a week after the Paris gun and suicide bomb attacks, a group of heavily armed gunmen stormed the Radisson Blu Hotel in Bamako, the capital of Mali, a former French colony, in which 21 people were killed. There have been a string of recent high-profile terror attacks, from bombings in Beirut and the downing of a Russian airline over the Sinai Desert. Where do you think we should begin in trying to address all of these recent terror attacks?
I think there's a fundamental contradiction in the official narrative, both of the United States and, of course, of France and its allies. The United States is leading a war on terrorism, which is directed against the so-called Islamic State, yet the evidence amply confirms that the Islamic State and the various Al-Qaeda-related terrorist organizations are creations of U.S. intelligence. They're what are called in intelligence parlance, intelligence assets. And the other dimension, of course, is that, in effect, Obama is not waging a campaign against the terrorists, because these terrorists are in fact the foot soldiers of the Western Military Alliance in Syria, and they are in fact protecting the terrorists. This is amply confirmed, and it's come to our attention since the onset of the Russian bombing, and the Russians are going after the real terrorists. So that when an occurrence such as that of Paris or Bamako is presented then to the media, or that the media analyzes these events, what they do is simply copy and paste the official narrative without presenting an understanding of who is actually behind these terrorist organizations. Almost immediately, in the wake of the terrorist attacks in Paris, the French media went into overdrive, stating unequivocally, and that was prior to the conduct even of a police investigation, that the Islamic State was indelibly behind these attacks. And then the president François Hollande ordered by decree a national emergency, the suspension of civil liberties, the right to enter homes and arrest people without a warrant, and at the same time he closed down the borders. Now this, as I recall, was announced a few minutes before midnight on November 13th local time, prior to any consultation with his cabinet colleagues. He actually confirmed that the cabinet meeting was to take place subsequently, and in his speech he says, "We know who they are." And immediately the French media says, "This is a French style 9/11. And they, in other words, in French, he says, "Le 11 septembre. Le 11 septembre à la française." And following from that, the official story prevails. But the official story is based with a fundamental, as I mentioned, a fundamental contradiction. You can't, on the one hand, say you're the victim of the Islamic State when, in fact, you're the creator of the Islamic State. It's a non sequitur. You cannot say that the attacks, and he was very explicit, the attacks from outside France, from Syria, originating from Syria. You can't say that the attacks originating from Syria directed against the French Republic, and at the same time support covertly these same terrorists. And there's ample evidence that not only the United States and its allies have supported the ISIS and its affiliate groups, such as the Libya Islamic Fighting Group, so has France, with weapons, with training, with financing, and so on. So that is the situation. And what the French public and Western public in general have been led to believe is that these terrorists are involved in crimes against humanity, without realizing that in fact their intelligence services, which are under the auspices of an elected government, are manipulating these terror organizations, are supporting them, are providing them with weapons.
You write that the Islamic State, ISIS, the alleged architect of the Paris attacks, was originally an Al-Qaeda-affiliated entity created by U.S. intelligence with the support of Britain's MI6, Israel's Mossad, Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence, ISI, and Saudi Arabia's General Intelligence Presidency, GIP. You write that, quote, from the outset of Obama's bombing campaign in August-September 2014, the U.S.-led coalition has not bombed ISIS rebel positions, unquote. Has the U.S. counterterrorism campaign been fake?
Well, absolutely. This is a self-proclaimed counterterrorism campaign, but in effect, it is there to justify the bombing of a sovereign country in derogation of international law. The United States has been pressuring the government of Bashar al-Assad to step down. They want regime change. And they have not been able to achieve that despite 4 years of intensive terrorist activities, which they sponsor on the ground. And in the last year, we're talking about a bombing raid which has lasted for 13 months or more, and which is in effect supporting those terrorist entities. Now, we can say, well, where do you get the information as to who is behind these terrorists? And I can tell you that from day one, in March 2011, the terrorists were sent in with the support of the Western Military Alliance. And in fact, this was reported in August 2011 by DEPCA, which is an intelligence online media, which I'm not saying that I trust DEPCA, but they acknowledge very clearly, and it's corroborated by other reports, that the initiative of the Western Military Alliance was actually launched by NATO, and it consisted in setting up a campaign to enlist thousands of Muslim volunteers in Muslim countries, which would then be coordinated by NATO in Brussels and the Turkish High Command. And that is exactly what has happened. And it took a long time for Western public opinion to actually even realize that the so-called opposition forces against the government, Bashar al-Assad, were actually terrorists. And then when these atrocities were committed, they'll say invariably, and they probably still do, the Western media would blame Bashar al-Assad of killing his own people. Well, we have enough information to know that this so-called war on terrorism is fake. The United States and its allies are involved in a criminal undertaking in violation of international law against a sovereign country, its geopolitics, its economic conquest, and they're using the war on terrorism as a pretext. And now the bombing campaign is really in response to the fact that government forces in 2014 actually had managed to pacify a large part of Syrian territory, and the terrorists had been terrorist pockets had been eliminated. So they initiated the bombing campaign, and then they fast-tracked the recruitment and training of terrorists out of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and so on and so forth. All of this is known. And the thing is that the Western media will actually acknowledge the fact that Turkey is responsible for this, that, and other, that Saudi Arabia, we can't trust them, they're supporting the terrorists, Qatar is supporting the terrorists. But, of course, the Western countries are not supporting the terrorists, even though their allies are obeying orders. I mean, Qatar is not really a country. It's a proxy state in the Persian Gulf. It obeys orders. There's a whole series of military and intelligence bases there, close to Doha, the capital of Qatar. Saudi Arabia, the same. These are countries which are aligned with Washington. They receive military aid. They are told what to do. And historically, going back to the Soviet-Afghan War, we know that Pakistan's military intelligence, inter-services intelligence, ISI, and its Saudi counterparts were funding this operation. They were recruiting the terrorists. It's corroborated by Brzezinski and so on and so forth. All this is known, and the CIA does not deny it. What they say, of course, is that in the wake of the Cold War, they ceased their relationship with al-Qaeda, and then al-Qaeda turned against us, so to speak. This is absolute nonsense. Because I can tell you for one thing is that the actual terrorists continued to be trained in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And in fact, the proclaimed architect of the bombing of the hotel in Bamako, Belmokhtar, was recruited by the CIA in 1991. The Soviet-Afghan war was already over. The Cold War was over. And the CIA was continuing to recruit these people. Who were they recruiting? They were recruiting potential intelligence assets, which could then be deployed in a number of countries. The former Soviet Union, of course, the Russian Federation, Chechnya, but also in the Middle East. And it just so happens that Mokhtar Belmokhtar was trained in Pakistan and Afghanistan by the CIA, and then he was sent back in 93 to Algeria, and today he is behind a fraction of what is called Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. And the operation which was launched in Bamako allegedly was undertaken by his group on the one hand, and the broader organization which is called Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, AQIM, which is an affiliate of Al-Qaeda. I should mention that AQIM is also very much integrated with the so-called Libya Islamic Fighting Group, which was supported by NATO during the campaign, the NATO campaign against Libya in 2011. So that NATO supports the Libya Islamic Fighting Group, which in effect has more or less merged with AQIM, the architect of the Bamako bombing, this mythical figure, Mokhtar Belmokhtar, is actually trained by the CIA. There's CIA all over the place, and they cannot deny, because the evidence is so compelling, that the intelligence services of Western countries are supporting the terrorists, and at the same time, the governments of Western countries are waging a campaign allegedly against the Islamic State, when in fact they're also supporting the Islamic State, and they're using this as a pretext to bomb a sovereign country, resulting in tens of thousands of casualties, a refugee crisis, the destruction of entire cities, and so on, during a period of 4 years. That is the picture. And we don't need to start engaging in any kind of conspiracy theories to underscore the fact that if the intelligence services of France and the United States are supporting ISIS, and ISIS is designated as the threat to the security of the French nation, there's an obvious contradiction. Because you can't support the ISIS and then make a speech at 12 o'clock at night, I'm talking about President Hollande, and say, we know who they are, they're attacking us, okay? They're killing our people. So I think, to put it mildly, President François Hollande has blood on his hands.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, State Terrorism, Franco-American Style. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Now, you've been referring to the Bamako, Mali attacks, the most recent terror attacks. News media report that the Bamako terror operation was coordinated by Mokhtar Belmokhtar, whom you have mentioned. What do you think is the significance of the Bamako attacks? And were the Mali attacks in Bamako related to the Paris terror? For instance, what was France's role in the Libyan war and the takedown of Muammar Gaddafi? Is this all related?
Well, let me put it this way. Both attacks, both the Paris attacks as well as the Bamako attacks, have geopolitical implications. First, with regard to Paris, it's worth noting that 1 week before these attacks occurred, Paris, the Hollande government, had ordered the deployment of the Charles de Gaulle aircraft carrier group to the Mediterranean, to the Eastern Mediterranean, and this was in support of the alleged campaign against terrorism in Syria, so that they were actually, even before these attacks occurred, they'd already been preparing to send this powerful navy and air force deployment to the Middle East in support of Obama's campaign against the ISIS. And in the wake of the Paris attacks, as we recall, the French Air Force went in and bombed the alleged headquarters of ISIS, and the official declaration from the Ministry of Defense was that they had actually targeted the command posts. We got information from Syria that, in fact, what they targeted were health clinics, a museum, and the stadium. In other words, the country's civilian infrastructure. And that has been persistent throughout the last year since the United States started to bomb Syria. Now, with regard to Bamako, the geopolitical agenda is essentially to create a pretext and a justification for the intervention of France and the United States in sub-Saharan Africa. And they would be directing their actions, allegedly, of course, against terror organizations which threaten partner governments in Africa, which is nonsensical because they control those terror organizations, whether it's Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb or Boko Haram in Nigeria or the Libya Islamic Fighting Group. All these organizations are intelligence assets, and they're being used to destabilize sovereign countries. And now the Bamako attacks will no doubt also be used by France, by the United States, to extend, to, in a sense, to recolonize Africa in terms of militarization of the entire continent, the control over resources, etc., the destabilization of post-colonial societies, which they're doing. They're doing through various mechanisms. But I suspect that the geopolitics underlying the Bamako terror attack is militarization of Africa. And I should mention that U.S. AFRICOM also sent in a contingent into Mali to assist the French and Malian special forces, which stormed the hotel. And U.S. Africa Command is the key to this militarization of Africa. Now, I should mention that François Hollande is, in fact, a U.S. proxy. I mean, he acts on behalf of Washington. He has absolutely no concern in actually protecting the French spheres of influence in West Africa, for instance. And the alliance with the United States is it's a subordinate alliance. France is a subordinate to Washington, is in fact to pave the way towards the U.S. colonization of the African continent, which historically, as we recall, was really colonized by the Europeans. Okay, and they even in the late 19th century, they had a conference. It's called the Berlin Conference, where they carved up Africa into different sections and then divided the continent. But America was not included in that process. And now what we see emerging is, in fact, the displacement of the former colonial powers in Africa. Specifically, well, Portugal has already gone, and so has Spain, and so has Belgium, and France is ultimately being displaced by the United States. Francophone countries are becoming Americanized. The dollar will eventually replace the CFA franc, which is a proxy currency linked to the French. Well, it's linked to the French Treasury, but it's tied into the euro. And so that is the scenario. It's the conquest of the African continent, which is supported by the mandate, the self-proclaimed mandate of the Obama administration to go after the terrorists in sub-Saharan Africa, Boko Haram, Akim, and so on. And they're doing that in all the various areas where they want to extend their zone of influence. So you have, of course, in Southeast Asia, you'll have the Jamia Islami in Indonesia and Malaysia. And then you've got, of course, various other jihadist organizations in the western part of China, which are involved again in insurgencies, and they're also supported by Western intelligence via Pakistani's ISI.
It sounds like the United States and France are working very closely together, and that there is then evidence that French military escalation directed against Syria was planned before the November 13th terrorist attacks. What evidence is there, if any, of official foreknowledge of the Paris terror itself?
Well, you're absolutely right that France has been participating in the bombing raids right from the outset. And ironically, they operate out of the United Emirates, Arab Emirates, which in fact hosts the terrorist organizations or trains them and so on. Now, with regard to foreknowledge, I don't want to necessarily tackle it in those terms, but there were certain events which I considered revealing. The fact that about a month and a half before, there was an article in Paris Match, which is a bit, it's a tabloid magazine, which is widely read and very authoritative. And in this Paris Match report, it was stated that there would be, within a short period of time, there would be an attack. And they used the term 9/11 French style, Le 11 septembre à la Française. That was, in fact, the title of the article. And so that the Paris Match on October 2nd predicted a French-style 9/11. And they said that the attacks in France will be on a scale comparable to 9/11. And they also said that intelligence services fear a 9/11 French style. And then you ask yourself, well, what was the purpose of this media report? Is it media disinformation? Is it there to create a hype or create an atmosphere of fear and intimidation prior to the actual events? But ironically, when the events occurred, the media was actually simply restating what had been said about a month and a half ago. They said this is a terrorist attack similar to 9/11. And they also pointed immediately, without any evidence, to the fact that these attacks came from Syria. And then, of course, as we will recall, subsequently, a few days later, the French president, after having declared a national emergency, stated this is an act of war against us, despite the fact that this is not an act of war, it's simply an event, it's a terror event, it's not an act of war. But he said it's an act of war because we're being attacked by a foreign power, and that foreign power allegedly is in northern Syria somewhere, in Raqqa. It just so happens that we support these terrorists, but we have to invoke, in a sense, the fact that we're being attacked from outside, so that then we can also then claim with our coalition partners in NATO and the European Union the doctrine of collective security. That's Article 5 of NATO, which says an attack against one member of NATO is an attack against all members of NATO. And that's what they invoked on September the 12th, 2001, in the wake of 9/11, saying that it was an attack against the United States from abroad, although we didn't witness any Afghani planes in the skies of New York. But they're doing exactly the same. They're replicating the discourse, the 9/11 discourse, the fact that this is an attack from a foreign power. It just so happens that foreign power is in northern Syria somewhere, and they're using this as a pretext to escalate the war against Syria, not against their proxy terrorists in Raqqa, and to justify a new wave of bombing by coalition forces. And I think that is ultimately the agenda.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, State Terrorism, Franco-American Style.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
But then they have to confront Russia, because Russia is also... Russia is going after the real terrorists, okay? And I think that one of the dimensions of this particular attack is that they need now, they need a mechanism or a pretext to undermine Russia's endeavors, which consist essentially in destroying the foot soldiers of the Western Military Alliance, which are the terrorists, these various entities which are supported covertly by the CIA, by MI6, by Mossad, and which are integrated by special forces in permanent liaison with the Western Military Alliance. These foot soldiers, they have their commanders, and those commanders are also in liaison with NATO or the United States. And the fact is that Israel is also behind the terrorists, and we don't even need to speculate on that. They've actually said that they have a, you know, they have a facility in the Golan Heights. They're bringing in wounded terrorists from Syria into the Golan Heights with hospital facilities. They have Israeli advisors within the terrorist formations and so on. And we have photo ops, again, of Netanyahu with terrorist commanders being given hospital treatment in the Golan Heights. So the issue is that none of what we are discussing here will be given coverage in the mainstream media, and the public is drowned with a humanitarian discourse. Innocent people are being killed, and it's those events where terrorists attack innocent people which ultimately create within everybody this feeling of solidarity, of fear as well. But ultimately, when people die, we feel it, okay? And then what we do is that we side with the government, okay? That's what they're doing. Everybody's siding with the French government, even people who hate François Hollande, they're siding with the French government because the French government is there to protect them, and they are shocked and concerned about the loss of life. And that concept or that procedure there is well entrenched, in fact, in U.S. military doctrine. I should remind listeners of what was called Operation Northwoods. It was during the Kennedy administration. It was a secret plan by the Joint Chiefs of Staff to start killing people in the Miami Cuban community, as well as in Washington, with a view to justifying a war of retribution against Cuba. And I quote from the official document. They said we kill people in Miami, and that creates, quote, a useful wave of indignation. Okay? Indignation of U.S. public opinion, which is a normal thing. Okay? Everybody has indignation when people are killed. And then they say, well, Cuba, Fidel Castro has attacked America. We have to attack Cuba in retribution. Now, that is the logic of these so-called false flags. And Operation Northwoods, the documents are there. People can go and consult them, because those secret documents have been declassified after half a century. And we know that the U.S. military were contemplating this. It was turned down by Kennedy, and it was also turned down by the Defense Secretary McNamara at the time. Okay? So that, in effect, it was a plot from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, no doubt also supported by U.S. intelligence at the time. And just to mention one further element, the concept is what General Tommy Franks, who was Central Command commander responsible for the invasion of Iraq, and he called this a terrorist massive casualty producing event, which results in civilian casualties. And he said that in effect, these terrorist massive casualty producing events constitute an instrument which enables the government to militarize. In this case, he was talking about the United States, to militarize the United States. And in effect, that's exactly what's happening in France. Okay, the massive casualty producing event in Paris is being used as a pretext to declare martial law, to suspend civil liberties. It is what I'd call the end of the French Republic. It marks the end of the French Republic and the potential transition to a totalitarian regime under the disguise of democracy or representative government.
I'm glad you mentioned Operation Northwoods, because we are actually recording this interview on November 22nd, which is the 52nd anniversary of the assassination of the President of the United States, John Kennedy. And, of course, we have seen endless war ever since. In terms of the media coverage of the Paris terror attacks, it seems like the notion of revenge is being used as a motivating factor. And, of course, this is a contradictory claim, right?
Well, you know, revenge, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, has been with us for several thousand years. You need a pretext to wage war, and war in the modern context, and the leaders, the political leaders know that. They know that war is the ultimate crime under Nuremberg. Whatever the underlying motive, the only war which is allowed is a war of self-defense, okay? You're allowed to defend yourself against aggression. But under Nuremberg, any act of war against a foreign country is a criminal undertaking. And what these attacks and deaths of civilians are there to perform is to give a mandate to the government to initiate a war of retribution against a foreign country, in this case Syria, even though Syria, they're not even saying officially that the Syrian government is behind the terrorists. They'll probably start saying that at one point, okay, when in fact we know that Bashar al-Assad has been combating terrorism from mid-March of 2011, okay? It's been a battle of government forces against terrorism, and those terrorists are supported by foreign powers, so that certainly Syria can invoke self-defense. But for France to invoke self-defense on the grounds that it's been attacked by some elusive entity in northern Syria is far-fetched. But it seems that people are buying it. They're saying, yes, we have to act and an act of revenge. Now, the other dimension is that throughout France, the police are on a rampage. We have official figures as to the number of house searches and arrests and so on, but none of those official figures actually should be taken seriously, because what's happening now is that the Muslim community of France, which represents approximately, it's something somewhat less of 10% of the population, these people are being subjected to a witch hunt. So that we're in a situation which might be called the Spanish Inquisition. But I should mention historically the French Inquisition of the Middle Age was far worse. But so it's an inquisitorial type of situation where you're going after people. The wave of the anti-terrorism is coupled with Islamophobia. And ultimately, it's quite logical from a geopolitical or economic standpoint to demonize Muslims, because it just so happens that the Muslims are the inhabitants of countries which possess the world's oil reserves, okay? I mean, I've made the calculus is that up to 65 to 70% of the reserves of crude oil, I'm not talking about natural gas or other forms of oil like tar sands, but between 65 and 70% of crude oil reserves are in Muslim countries, a large part of which is, of course, in that region extending from the tip of Saudi Arabia up to the Caspian Sea basin. Now, so if those countries which have those oil reserves happen to be Buddhists, the whole campaign would be directed against Buddhists. They need to demonize the Muslims as a pretext to wage their battle for oil.
And, of course, what begins as a demonization of Muslims or whatever group ultimately laps over into everybody else, right? The population at large. You've mentioned the state of emergency that has been declared in France. Drastic police state measures, I would assume, are part of such a state of emergency, arbitrary arrest. And you mentioned that we're witnessing an end to the French Republic.
Absolutely. But the thing is that what is implied there is that to enforce an imperial agenda, you scrap the Republic. Now, Julius Caesar understood that perfectly well. I can't remember the exact quote, but he said, you don't build an empire with a republic. And I think that, in effect, what's happening is that the republic is being scrapped. It's not only being scrapped in France, it's being scrapped in America. Now, I just recall that, that Donald Trump, in his election campaign, is calling for police state measures directed against every single Muslim in the United States of America, okay? And establishing some kind of database to track Muslims in the U.S., okay? Now, he was rebuffed by his Republican cohorts, but nonetheless, that type of political narrative, which is based on promoting hate, is becoming very popular, and the promotion of hate is derived from these mass casualty producing events by the propaganda of the demonization of Muslims and so on. People are being used to share this divisiveness, okay, when in fact people around the world, everybody is equal. Ultimately, we're all human beings, and we should be in solidarity with one another. And if it weren't for our leaders, which have geopolitical and economic intents of building and extending the empire, most probably we would all be rejoicing together in a multicultural environment. But that's not happening. And it's particularly serious in countries like, I'd say, Britain and France. Britain also is very much becoming very sectarian, and in the United States as well, up to a point.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, State Terrorism, Franco-American Style. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You've written that the global war on terrorism is a lie that provides legitimacy to police state measures. What do you think is behind the drive toward creating police states in what we might refer to as former republics?
Well, the police state is there to serve economic and geopolitical interests, strategic interests. It's there to support major corporate interests, the oil companies, the military-industrial complex, the defense contractors, Wall Street. And in effect, it's still a profit-driven. I mean, war is an economic endeavor. Okay, war is good for business, so to speak. And it's also It provides business to the people who produce the weapons, but it also extends the markets worldwide. And then, of course, initiatives, these so-called trade agreements, TPP and others, are tied into the military agenda. They're not isolated phenomena, and there's an interface. It's not by accident that Paul Wolfowitz, for instance, went from the U.S. Defense Department to the World Bank and back and forth and so on. There's an interface in Washington between the military and civilian entities, between the Treasury and the Pentagon, and then, of course, all these organizations such as the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, are part and parcel of that broader agenda. And what it really means, ultimately, is that politicians are no longer politicians. They are the instruments of lobby groups. I think we understand that. In an American context, we understand that. They're lobby groups which own the politicians, okay? And then ultimately, those politicians are incited by their corporate sponsors to commit criminal acts, because Obama, in waging a campaign against Syria, is involved in a criminal act. It's against the law to go and bomb a sovereign country on whatever pretext. And it brings forth the notion of the criminalization of the state, namely the fact that the state is no longer there representing citizens, but it's representing corporations. Those corporations, in turn, are also involved in criminal undertakings. The financial system is fraudulent. It's criminalized. They get away with it. I mean, to maintain appearances, there's an occasional lawsuit against Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan Chase. But there's no actual confiscation of financial assets, as occurred, let's say, in Iceland, where in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, they actually confiscated the banks, and now they are actually redistributing the wealth to citizens. I mean, this is a rather unique occurrence. It's not to say that this means a change, a complete change in structure, but you don't see governments protecting the rights of citizens against powerful corporations. Corporations are running the world. The trade agreements override the Constitution. We know that, and there's an imperial agenda, which is ultimately an economic agenda. And the irony is that the United States is now set up a whole series of alliances with countries which were the victims of U.S. war crimes. I'm thinking of Vietnam, Cambodia, the Philippines, Indonesia. They're all allies of the United States, and that alliance is now directed against the People's Republic of China, which constitutes an encroachment to global hegemony. Not to say that China is necessarily an alternative. I don't think it is. But from a geopolitical standpoint, there are certain countries which the United States wants to get rid of, and that is, of course, the Russian Federation, the People's Republic of China, Iran, and, of course, North Korea. Those are the four countries that are encroachments. There may be others, but they're of less importance. And it's not by accident that all these four countries are being threatened simultaneously. In fact, the U.S. has negotiated an agreement with South Korea, which threatens North Korea. And I should mention, North Korea lost 30% of its population during the Korean War. And this is something which is well understood, because General Curtis LeMay actually said in a speech, "We must have killed something of the order of 20% and destroyed something like 90% of the country's cities during the bombing raids which they implemented." And these atrocities have been committed in various parts of the world. Indonesia, you know, 500,000 to a million so-called communist sympathizers were killed on orders of the CIA. It's documented, because we actually have the declassified documents of the CIA on that event. and so on and so forth. So I would call this the criminalization of the state. And the criminalization of the state is totalitarian because it goes against the rights of the citizens. It has an interest in retaining a democratic facade, a two-party system, the institutions of representative democracy. But we know that whoever comes into the White House, whether it's Hillary or Donald Trump, you know, or Jeb Bush, they will ultimately be figureheads, public relations figureheads, which will support dominant economic interests in the United States.
You write that, quote, the evidence amply confirms that while Russia is targeting ISIS strongholds in Syria, the Western military alliance is supporting the Islamic State terrorists, unquote. The Russian Federation is bombing ISIS while the Western military alliance is supporting the terrorists, but publicly everyone claims to be fighting ISIS. Is there an undeclared war going on between the Russian Federation and the Western military alliance?
Well, ultimately, yes, there is an undeclared war, and it could evolve in different directions, because the Russians are, in fact, targeting the foot soldiers of the Western military alliance. And, I mean, they're destroying the endeavors of the United States and its intelligence services, its military. Within the ranks of those terrorists are Western military advisors. We know that. But at the same time, the U.S. and its European partners have to play the game, so to speak. And they can't simply say to the Russians, well, you know, you're not actually, because it's so obvious, even to the broader public, that Obama's campaign has, so to speak, failed, whereas the Russian campaign, with limited air facilities, has actually, in a matter of a few weeks, has managed to undermine this terrorist presence inside Syria. You know, the apologists will say, or some people even on the left, they'll say, well, Obama's made a mistake. You know, he's screwed up. He doesn't know how to coordinate these attacks, et cetera, as if, okay? They have these terrorists in Toyota pickup trucks. If they had wanted to eliminate them, they could have done it very easily right at the beginning when they crossed the desert from Syria into Iraq. But the purpose was not to destroy them. The purpose was actually to protect them, so that the U.S. has been very effective in protecting them and also in dispelling an understanding by public opinion that they actually were involved in supporting the terrorists rather than going after them. And now, of course, the ball game is different because the Russians are there. And ironically, they have established channels of cooperation, let's say, between France and Russia with regard to counterterrorism. But Putin is a very astute diplomat, as well as he's, of course, an intelligence, a former KGB official, and he knows how to play that kind of game. He hasn't accused, the Russian media isn't accusing François Hollande of being complicit in these attacks. Quite the opposite. They're saying, buddy, buddy, Putin comes up to François Hollande and says, let's cooperate, let's collaborate. And then Hollande is going to go to Moscow. And that, of course, in a sense, may create some divisiveness within the Western military alliance. It may also uphold the legitimacy of François Hollande, because he's not being bashed by the Russians. And there's a very careful game which is ongoing. But if you look at the broader picture, namely the fact that NATO, U.S. NATO, is at Russia's doorstep in Eastern Europe, in the Baltic states, for instance, both with conventional weapons as well as the air defense the defense shield. And they say that the defense shield is directed not against Russia but against Iran, which is nonsensical. It's directed against every single major Russian city, okay? So they're targeting them there. Then they are, of course, they're supporting an illegal government in Ukraine, which is integrated by neo-Nazis. That is ongoing. And they are intent on destabilizing the Russian economy through sanctions, through financial mechanisms. That's also ongoing. But in turn, what has happened, what has emerged, is that Russia has, Russians' actions in the military sphere have shown the Americans that we can do what you can do. We have advanced capabilities, which everybody knows they have. And it is ultimately, it appears to be the source of tremendous diplomatic embarrassment that the Russians have been able to liquidate the terrorists in a matter of months. And the United States has been so inept, but in fact they haven't been inept because they never intended to actually go after the terrorists.
Michel Chosadovsky, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show has been State Terrorism, Franco-American Style. Michel Chosadovsky is the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. The Global Research website, globalresearch.ca, publishes news articles, commentary, background research, and analysis. Michel Chosadovsky is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity, as well as co-editor of the anthology The Global Economic Crisis, The Great Depression of the 21st Century. All books are available at globalresearch.ca. That's globalresearch.ca. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. To leave comments or order copies of shows, email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. That's F-A-U-L-K-N-E-R at GUNSANDBUTTER.org. Visit our website at gunsandbutter.org to sign up for our email list and receive our newsletter. Follow us at G&B Radio.
Hey!
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes. This is Kenneth Doust. Political scientist Michael Parenti has done as much as anybody to clarify my thinking about the world. Here's a point of his that really hit home. We often see a big gap between the professed goals and principles of powerful institutions and the actual effects of their actions. And we think, those blockheads, can't they see that they're producing the opposite results of what they want? I recall a meeting of a local peace group. They decided to write to President W. Bush to try to get him to see that destroying Iraq wasn't helping his war on terrorism. In fact, it was only creating more terrorists. They'd explain it to Bush, and he'd see the error of his tactics and change them, and as the multitude sang Kumbaya, the world would become a better and more peaceful place. Parenti's insight is that the blockhead isn't Bush, it's the Peace Committee. People who take the government's professed goals at face value and then brilliantly discover that the means employed produce results at odds with the professed goals, and who then imagine that informing the nitwits in power of their own brilliant discovery will make the nitwits smarten up. People who fail to infer the real goals and real motives of the powerful. People who take obvious lies at face value. People who don't see that just because they've confused you doesn't mean that they're confused. These people are the blockheads, not Bush and Obama. Today we'll hear from three people, none of whom is a blockhead. They are Hartford activist Steve Fournier and political scientist David Modell, and last, Afghan democracy activist Malalai Joya. And it turns out all talk about Afghanistan. Why? Because the Afghan war, or is it the AFPAC war, is another spree of criminal bloody murder based on lies and paid for with your tax dollars. And maybe it's time the multitudes stopped singing Kumbaya and started singing Won't Get Fooled Again. Here's Steve Fournier.
Sport of Cowards. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton referred to a suicide bombing in Pakistan during her visit there as cowardly. She may be right about that, but no American diplomat should dare breathe that word while unmanned U.S. aircraft are launching missiles on houses and farms in distant lands. In a match as uneven as that between the U.S. and what's left of Afghanistan and Pakistan, most of the cowardliness is on our side. And it's becoming more and more difficult, even for patriots, to sympathize with the victors. Valor is unnecessary in this contest, and none is displayed. All the carnage is done by remote control. No nation has ever had the capacity to kill with the coldness we are now able to effect. We have weapons guaranteed to destroy populations that can be launched from thousands of miles away, and we can keep track of targets from space. There is no contest between soldiers, but only between people on the one side and machines on the other. Uniformed American terrorists, busy at automated workstations in Nevada, see more blood after shaving than they do in a month of what is now called combat or fighting. They willingly incinerate babies without ever risking a hair of their own. The press, as we affectionately still call the news desk of our entertainment industry, is positively buoyant over the drone attacks, content that we are inflicting more casualties than we are sustaining. Most public policy is now carried on to satisfy these folks' demands, and the current military adventures are no exception. Political correctness, of which newsmen are the authors, requires that Americans be victorious in all military engagements And so explosions in foreign cities are like music to a correspondent's ears. There is no legal authority for what our government is now doing. Bombing people with robots is recognized everywhere but here as a war crime. And it was only very recently that our government and the media began to advocate the assassination of foreigners. It's against our laws, and so are our various military adventures. There is a procedure in the Constitution for war, but we have not followed it, and so all of this killing is unlawful. The nation's founders must be spinning in their graves. The idea of a sovereign targeting and killing people without arrest, trial, or any determination of guilt was an old one by the time Jefferson and Adams came of age. Although they disagreed on much, they were united against this sort of justice. What's ironic is the spirit of compliance that seems to be in vogue now. You can't get people to obey the speed limits, but they seem willing and even eager to give up basic civil rights. Almost nobody is kicking about the nation's assassination policy, even though it should raise some questions. For instance, do I, as a citizen, have a legal right to advocate your assassination? May I advocate government death squads in general to terminate wrongdoers? May I advocate the assassination of named individuals, such as Osama, for instance? If I say Democratic office holders should be lined up and shot, am I doing something wrong, or am I guilty merely of bad taste? Can I say my neighbor should be killed? My ex-spouse, Charles Manson, Jesse Jackson, Janet Jackson? If I can't do it, then neither can Obama. The law gives neither of us a license to kill. Honor, courage, and the rule of law may simply be the price a nation must pay to bask in the luxury of superpower status. Today, it's mass murder by remote control. We can only imagine what feats of cowardice will become possible if we keep to the present course.
Political scientist David Modell seconds Steve Fournier's point that all the lies in the world won't turn a war crime into a bed of roses. Modell goes a step further and infers the real reason NATO is killing Afghanistan. Bin Laden be damned. It's trouble with a capital T, which rhymes with P, which stands for, well, listen on. Modell's essay was published November 13 in Counterpunch Online. I've edited it a little for radio. It's titled NATO's Chimerical Enemy in Afghanistan. Interesting adjective. A chimera is an imaginary monster compounded of incongruous parts, like John Barth's fiction. Here's Modell. The narrative of the Afghan campaign against the Taliban could have been written by Samuel Beckett or Harold Pinter. Sidebar comment, typical Canadian. Modell cites an Irishman and an Englishman while overlooking a better American example, John Barth, author of a volume of fiction whose very title is Chimera. Sorry, I'm having another graduate school flashback. Back to Afghanistan. The main actors in this absurd fiasco are either unaware of the real history of recent events in Afghanistan or, more likely, are consciously pursuing the de facto objective of stabilizing the country under American control for the purpose of constructing and safeguarding a pipeline from the Caspian Basin to the ocean. The Taliban took power in 1996. The Clinton administration immediately extended the red carpet to them because the administration thought they could cajole the Taliban into signing an agreement to construct a pipeline. After wining and dining the Taliban and executives of the oil company Unocal, the Clinton officials discovered that the Taliban had already signed an agreement with an Argentinian company. The Taliban refused to revoke this agreement. The Clinton administration also wanted to solve the problem of the Taliban's support for terrorist training camps in Afghanistan. Forces trained there were responsible for a number of terrorist attacks, including the attack on the USS Cole in Yemen. After negotiating with Clinton, the Taliban agreed to stop supporting the training camps in exchange for foreign aid. Unfortunately, before the deal was signed, George W. Bush was sworn in as president. From the beginning, the Bush administration had secret plans to invade Afghanistan in order to build and protect a pipeline. They began planning the invasion in March 2001, 6 months before 9/11. Recognizing the dangers ahead, the Taliban offered three times to hand over bin Laden to the Americans. The Bush administration rebuffed them each time. Let me read that again. The Taliban offered three times to hand over bin Laden to the Americans. The Bush administration rebuffed them each time. Finally, in late 2001, after the invasion had begun, the Taliban offered both to hand over bin Laden and to close down all terrorist camps in Afghanistan. The administration rebuffed the Taliban yet again. Because the real reason for invading Afghanistan was not bin Laden, but the pipeline. America and NATO are now engaged in a bloody, foundering war with the Taliban and with angry Afghans who have lost relatives or friends to American indiscriminate bombing. Thousands of innocent peasants have been killed by collaterally challenged NATO bombers. There is no real economic development in Afghanistan, and the only opportunity to make life better there is to withdraw all the foreign troops. These troops have no right to be there in the first place and have been committing war crimes since they first stepped on Afghan soil. And Professor Modell ends on much the same note as Steve Fournier. The U.S. and NATO are committing war crimes aplenty in Afghanistan. And for what? Modell demolishes the Bush-Obama lies that were pursuing bin Laden and or driving out the evil Taliban. Bush had offered yet a third lie about why we're killing people in Afghanistan, that we're doing it to save the country's poor women from oppression. Here, refuting all three lies, is an Afghan woman, Malalai Joya. She was a member of the Afghan parliament until they unlawfully expelled her. She remains a crusader for democracy and human rights in her country. In a recent speech in Vancouver, Joya joins Modell in saying, the first step to this goal is getting the U.S. and NATO out of her country. Stop the bombing and stop supporting this criminal puppet man, as she calls him, President Karzai. And stop supporting the fascist warlords that he's allied with, whom we grandly call the Northern Alliance. All these people, and the Taliban too, are just competing gangs of oppressive, misogynistic fascists, Joya says. The only difference is that the Taliban never pretended they were fighting for democracy. We'll hear half of her 25-minute talk today. Joya's English is just a bit hard to understand. Obama is Obama, for example. If you take the trouble to listen carefully, though, I think you'll find it well worth the effort.
Right now, I come from a land of tragedy like Afghanistan that 8 years ago, after 9/11 tragedy, U.S. and NATO, they pushed us from the frying pan into the fire. These Northern Alliance fundamentalists, who are brother in creed of the Taliban, they did civil war in Afghanistan from 92 to 96. Alone in Kabul, in the capital of my country, they killed more than 65,000 innocent civilians. And to know better about them, you can see Human Rights Watch website, Amnesty International website, and many books has been written about them. But these fascist people, these cruel people, that they are a bunch of killers and puppets, and first of all, misogynists, seem like Taliban, they come in power and imposed on my people. That's why today's situation for my people is quite catastrophic, especially for the women of my country, this half of population. Today, situation of women in most of provinces as catastrophic as it was under the domination of Taliban. But the only difference between Taliban period with now is that all of these crimes are happening under the name of democracy, women rights, human rights. We are talking about women rights in Afghanistan, but dear, most of women of my country, they do not have human life. These warlords, these misogynists who are in power, seem like Taliban. Together now, they even cut the nose and ears of the woman through hot water on them. 1 month before, in Mazar Sharif, a misogynist man cut into pieces two women. Today, killing of women, that much easy for these warlords like killing a bird. Rape cases, kidnappings, acid attacks, domestic violences, kidnapping of women are increasing rapidly. 14-year-old Bashira was a young girl that she has been raped by three men, one of them son of the member of the parliament, Haji Payinda. He is the cruel commander of Abdul Rashid Dostum. And he changed the age of his son by document less than 18 that do not be punished, and now he's free. That's why these violences against women increasing rapidly, because they are not only Taliban, warlords as well, that who are in power together continue to their fascism. The women of my country, even they didn't gain the limited rights that they enjoyed in the centuries of 60s, 70s, and 80s. U.S. government, NATO, Canada, shamelessly they portray themselves to the, they are telling big lies to the people of their country through mainstream media that first time we brought women rights in Afghanistan, which is not true. As after 9/11 tragedy, they said to you that women do not wear burqa now and they are free, etc. Many propaganda like that, while today most of women are wearing burqa to be alive. Today this disgusting burqa, which is symbol of oppression, as always I'm saying, it's like shred for life body, but this burqa today give lives. It is true in some big cities like Kabul, Herat, Mazar Sharif, when you go, some women, they have access to job and education. First of all, even in these big cities do not have my people security, men and women. But in faraway provinces, situation for my people, especially women, is like hell. Today, they are not only women of my country that who suffer a lot. Millions of Afghan men and women, both of them do not have liberation at all. They suffer from injustice, insecurity, corruption, joblessness, poverty, etc. U.S. and NATO, including Canada government, occupied my country under the banner of women rights. And day by day, these warlords who are with the mask of democracy, they are in power. They themselves tear their mask for the great people around the world. Maybe you hear that recently these Shia fundamentalists in Afghanistan, they made misogynist law against Shia women in my country, which is quite similar like Taliban. 7 article of this law is completely like Taliban period, you can see in Human Rights Watch website, but let me give you one example of this law. They ban women to go out or go to the doctor or have job without permission of their husband, which is elementary rights of the woman. And this disgusting law, despite national and international condemnation, has been passed and has been signed by Hamid Karzai, this shameless puppet man, who did compromise with these terrorist misogynists, and still he is doing compromise with them. The only difference between Taliban period with now is that, day by day, these warlords, they are making legal their crimes. If they make this kind of disgusting law or do not make, they are already in power and continue to their fascism. To know better about deep tragedy of my country, I think only this point is enough that after 8 years, they changed my country to the center of drug. Today, 93% of opium produced from Afghanistan. And recently, maybe you also got this news from New York Times that brother of Hamid Karzai, Ahmad Wali Karzai, is a famous drug trafficker. In the meantime, receiving millions of dollars by CIA. My people call him a small bush in Kandahar province. And many other drug lords who have high post in Karzai's regime, they are in power. That's why since 2001 until now, 4,500% opium increased. And every year, through dirty business of opium, $500 million alone goes into the pocket of Taliban. And to know better about the ongoing catastrophic situation of my country, this example also enough that recently UNDP gave report that Afghanistan is ranked 181st out of 182 countries. Regarding official reports, $36 billion the government of Hamid Karzai this 8 years received from the international community under the name of orphans, widows, reconstruction of Afghanistan, education, etc. But most of these money went into pocket of warlords, drug lords, these NGO lords, donors, and these officials themselves. FAO gave report that 18 million people of Afghanistan, they live on less $2 a day. Media in Afghanistan give report to mother of my country in Herat and Ghor province, they are ready to sell their babies for only $10 because cannot feed them. In many examples like this, as now it become open secret for the great people around the world. But still your government, Canada government, being part of NATO, that this 8 years they followed the wrong policy of the U.S. government, they are sending their more taxpayer money to such a mafia corrupt system of Hamid Karzai. Now my people, they squashed between two powerful enemies. From the sky, occupation forces bombing, killing civilians, most of them women and children, under the name of Taliban. In the ground, Taliban and warlords together continue to their fascism. Before to tell you about role of the troops, let me say on behalf of my people, condolences to you, to those suffer mom in Canada and also other countries who lost their sons and their daughter in my country as a soldier. My message to them is that please change your sorrows and your tears to the strength and raise your voice against the wrong policy, against the war crime of your government. Because these troops themselves are the victim of the wrong policy of their government because send them for bad cause, for war. Your government, U.S. government, say war of Afghanistan is good war, war of Iraq is bad war. I don't know what's the difference between the word of war. And role of these troops in Afghanistan. Few examples is enough to know better about their role, as recently in Faro province on May this year, they did bombing, and one day more than 150 civilians has been killed, most of them women and children. Even they used white phosphorus and cluster bomb. 11 bodies their family still didn't find because they has been cut into pieces. Even they are bombing our wedding parties, what they did in Ningarhar, in Nuristan, and also in Kandahar. In Ningarhar, 47 innocent civilians, including the groom and bride, in a wedding party has been killed when these occupation forces did bombing. On 9th of September, recently, 200 civilians has been killed in Kunduz province in the north of Afghanistan when they did bombing. After all of these war crime, Karzai's mafia system, this corrupt system, say apologize. Sorry, White House says apologize, and Karzai's mafia system, this corrupt system, this puppet regime, say thank you. That is it. I think the blood of my people is not water that they shed. It worth as much as the blood of Westerner worth. Regarding official figures, less than 2,000 Talib has been killed. More than 8,000 innocent civilians has been killed, most of them women and children. You can see Professor Mark Herald's website, this great Democrat American man who dedicated his hours to this website, and you can see the pictures of these victims in his website as well. And still they continue to their war crime in my country. But when Mr. Obama took office, unfortunately, his first news for my people was more conflict, more war. Foreign policy of Obama is quite similar like criminal Bush. And I think if Obama really honest for my people, first of all, he must say apologize to my people and end this occupation, criticize this criminal Bush. I think only criticize is not enough. He must try to bring this criminal Bush to the International Criminal Court for the war crime he committed. And now Obama decorated barbaric Taliban as a moderate to bring them also in power while we have no moderate Talib. They put soft name on these towers to have a reason through mainstream media to you to bring Taliban also in power, to make complete the circle of warlordism, drug lordism, terrorism in my country. Also, they are trying to bring a fascist man like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who his name is in the blacklist of the UN. Criminal Bush put price on the head of this terrorist man, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, $25 million if anybody find the dead or alive body of this terrorist. But Mr. Obama invited him to join the government as well. And now he starts war in Pakistan as well. I think situation of Iraq and Afghanistan is enough better to know that democracy never come by war, by cluster bomb, by barrel of gun, by white phosphorus. And you are looking that now Obama following war in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Pakistan, in supporting the criminal regime of Israel, what's going on today in Palestine, then receiving Nobel Peace Prize. So in such disastrous situation, they are talking about so-called free election in Afghanistan, which is very ridiculous. I think it was the most ridiculous and fraudulent election even in the world. Mr. Harper, your Prime Minister, called this election, this tragic drama in my country that says it was a successful election, which is a big lie. And also that other politicians, they are, through mainstream media, they are trying to put more dust on your eyes as well. I think you also agree with us, election under the shadow of gun, warlordism, drug lordism, awful corruption and occupation forces has no legitimacy at all. My people, people on the streets, before of the result of the election, they use this proverb, the winner will be like the same donkey, but with new saddle. And you saw the same donkey, but with same saddle come in power. Hopefully do not be insulted to the donkeys, this useful animal.
Malalai Joya was talking about the predicted results of the recent so-called election in Afghanistan. But don't her words hit home about our own change of administration? Same donkey, new saddle. And apologies to real donkeys. You can hear all of this admirable speech at our show's website, http://newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Now that baseball season is over, the American national pastime reverts to making fun of Canadians. And I've done my share this half hour, eh? But seriously, for the Malalai Joya talk, thanks to the good folks of Vancouver, to www.stopwar.ca, and to the admirable Canadian alternative radio guy, Alex Smith, of station CFRO and www.ecoshock.org. For the latest Jeremiads of Steve Fournier in print, check out www.currentinvective.com. And thanks to Steve for recording Sport of Cowards exclusively for New World Notes. This program comes to you from the spacious underground studios of community station WWUH-FM, provided rent-free by that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. As for the opinions expressed here, it goes without saying that, not to mention... Ah, yes, another John Barth reference. Ah, thanks for listening. I'll get to my non-carborundum. And please, let's all resolve we won't get fooled again. Ciao.
This is the Taylor Report. It's CIUT 89.5 FM. Remind you that this month, March 20, 12 o'clock, Hart House Debates Room. CIUT.FM we're sponsoring a talk by David Barsamian, a celebrated broadcaster and known for his famous, for his interviews with Noam Chomsky and others. And you can go to our site, CIUT.FM, and go to the tickets, and I hope you'll do that. I think we might be joined now by Mr. Murray Dobbin. Are you there, sir?
I am.
By golly, everybody's so efficient around here, I didn't know you were there. Sorry. Murray, you have written an article, which I found at Counterpunch and Tai, and it's titled Justin Trudeau's Shame, Extending Carte Blanche to Israel. And, gee, you wrote this just at the time that everybody's so satisfied that our prime minister is being appreciated by 60 Minutes, and he's cute and handsome. Well-spoken. But this isn't – you didn't find this very cute or a good decision.
No. Well,
what happened there?
It's typical of virtually every Canadian government and actually every Canadian political leader. I mean, this particular resolution was so appalling. I mean, it really does – it doesn't actually change a whole lot in a way, but it's just so offensive to – I mean, it's not even so much about Israel. It's a resolution that the Liberal government supports. It's a conservative resolution in the House that condemns anyone who supports the boycott, divest, and sanction campaign against Israel, which, of course, is a campaign that that began really back in. Well, I guess it was like 2008, I think. It was a campaign that was decided upon as an alternative to to armed struggle against Israel, which of course it's the fifth most powerful army in the world. You're not likely to win an armed struggle with them. So this was a decision to pursue a peaceful strategy, and a lot of people, including the people who designed the campaign and launched it, have drawn parallels with the boycott strategy that eventually brought an end to apartheid in mm-hmm. South Africa. But for the Liberal government, especially given that Justin Trudeau's father was the one who brought the Charter of Rights to life in Canada, to condemn people for promoting a peaceful action is just so offensive. It smacks of political cowardice.
Yeah. By the way, I was looking at it. They seemed, I guess it's not a nice word to say, but a little mealy-mouthed the way they were explaining their vote. Mr. Dion said, well, he didn't question the motivation or the intentions of the people who make up BDS. But nonetheless, he said, we're going to vote for this. I guess one thing we should say is that the Tories obviously were hoping to start off with something to make him stumble, right?
And so, well, yeah, they want to embarrass him, yeah.
Yeah.
And they succeeded.
Yes. This idea, why would they think that they would be in difficulty with the Canadian population if they said, no, we don't believe in suppressing free speech. There's nothing violent about this movement. And we've had many such movements. So what would they have lost if –
Well, I don't actually think they'd have lost anything, but the pro-Israeli lobby here is quite strong. Not nearly as strong, though, I have to say, as IPAC, the organization in the U.S., which is enormously powerful. There's a few organizations. They're not enormously well funded. There's B'nai B'rith and the Canadian Jewish Congress and groups like that. I mean, just as a side comment, I mean, I find it astonishing that these organizations think that they're doing Israel a favor by basically forcing a situation in which the two-state solution, which has been the internationally recognized solution to this for 20 years, they're basically making that impossible. And the two-state solution in reality is probably much better for Israel than trying to, you know, I mean, what are they going to do? Are they going to, you know, keep Palestinians as second-class citizens in an apartheid system for, what, 10, 20, 50, 100 years? I mean, this can't, I mean, it just is obvious to anyone who isn't addled by ideology that this can't last. I mean, it might last another 5 years, it might last another 10 years, but it cannot prevail in the long term. You cannot oppress people decade after decade after decade, and everything changes, right? I mean, you know, at some point Israel may not, in fact, be the, you know, the local cop for the United States. And even in the United States, there have been politicians and people in the military saying that, you know, that Israel, you know, American support for Israel is now becoming problematic in the Middle East. So, you know, the only thing that's certain in politics is change, and this kind of support for Israel is, as I end up in, you know, and my column ends up saying, this is not in Israel's interest. In fact, it's betraying the interest of Israel by giving a leader like Netanyahu carte blanche to do whatever he wants.
Yeah. By the way, in terms of the this movement, as you point out, is they have Mr. Netanyahu, who's probably, his numbers aren't very good. I don't know how good they are in Israel, but they're not very good elsewhere. And this campaign started, what, 2014? He said he wanted people to do something. You mentioned it. He, in a speech he gave in the U.S., he's talked about BDS 18 times.
Right.
And he urged them to fight back against BDS. And then it just sort of lands on this. I noticed the British Parliament, I don't think they actually decided yet, but they're talking about outlawing, making it illegal, aren't they? And to have a BDS organization.
Well, I don't know that, but it wouldn't surprise France? Me. And certainly, you know, the Harper government was, you know, actually talked really tough for a while. Said it was going to have a zero tolerance for criticism of Israel. Mm-hmm. Well, what the hell does that mean? You know, a zero tolerance for criticism of Israel. Yeah. And this whole notion of, and this came, of course, from the Israeli lobby and from Israeli politicians, that criticism of Israel is the new anti-Semitism, which is just farcical.
At this point, by the way, there are many supporters within Israel of the BDS.
Well, exactly, and there's also many Jews in Canada who support it. I mean, it's not, you know, the Jewish population in Canada is not monolithically behind Netanyahu by any means, but you know, people are intimidated by this, and of course it all goes back to the Holocaust. I mean, something that was so horrific and so unimaginable that any oppression of any other people just doesn't compare. So people are terrified of being called anti-Semitic and not paying due attention to the Holocaust. So Israel uses the Holocaust as a way of beating people up who criticize any of its policies.
Yeah. By the way, on the matter of the boycott, divest, BDS, reading your article, you underline that this is addressed to the issue of the occupied territories, right?
Actually, that's an error in the article, which I tried to correct. The boycott is against all Israeli goods. So I apologize for that, but it's all Israeli goods.
I'm just being your friendly editor.
That's very good. Yeah, I don't want to mislead people.
Yeah, you have quite a list of people that. You know, because you brought in this issue, and all of us do, one is very self-conscious in dealing with this because this word anti-Semitism is there. But then we find it, as you cite, Michael Ben-Yair, the Israel's attorney general from 1993 to 1996, he says it very clearly. We enthusiastically chose to become a colonial society, ignoring international treaties, expropriating lands, transferring settlers from Israel to the occupied territories. We developed two judicial systems, one progressive, liberal in Israel, the other cruel, injurious in the occupied territories. In effect, we established an apartheid regime in the occupied territories immediately following their capture. And then there's quite a list of former prime ministers. It's very... it's interesting. Those who've taken on the burden of trying to carry Mr. Netanyahu's project, they vary in their language, and it must be in the full knowledge that such prominent Israelis have said these things that it's kind of hard to label people.
Well, I mean, exactly. I mean, you know, all, especially, you know, when it comes to prime ministers and cabinet ministers, they have, you know, everybody knows the same facts. So it's not as if their advisors don't know this, and it's not as if the advisors to Stephen Harper didn't know these things. And Stephen Harper, you know, he went over the top. He went on and on about the comparison with apartheid and said it was sickening. Well, actually, if you look at what's happening to Palestinians in the occupied territories, it's far worse than apartheid. Apartheid, I mean, didn't deliberately try to humiliate people. Apartheid didn't do collective punishment where if some young kid threw a rock at a policeman, they didn't demolish the family's home. So Israeli apartheid is actually far worse in many respects than South Africa's was.
Yes. And by the way, there are South African Jewish leaders who have, of course, been in Israel. I think some are living there now who have said these very things. They said they've looked around, and a couple of them have said it's worse here.
Yeah, and Desmond Tutu has made that statement. He wrote a really powerful editorial, you know, pointing that out, that actually the stuff that goes on in Israel is far. I mean, I think what people need to understand is Israel can only do this if they establish in Israeli culture that Arabs are actually inferior. So, I mean, that's a strong statement to make. But let me give you. I don't have the quote in front of me because I used it in another article. But there was a British MP who visited Israel. I think it was in the 1970s, and met with the Foreign Affairs Committee. And one of the Israeli ministers or members of the Foreign Affairs Committee was going on and on about Arabs. And the British MP stopped him and said, "I can't believe that you're saying these things after your experience in the Holocaust. How can you speak about people this way?" And the person who had been speaking smashed his hands on the table and he says, "They're not people, they're Arabs."
Yeah.
So in order to maintain...
In Netanyahu's cabinet, there are a number of people who say those things.
Oh, sure, exactly. And some have actually suggested that all the, you know, all the... Arabs be expelled from Israel. So this is the most radically oppressive government in Israeli history. The notion that we would give them any comfort at all is really quite sad. I mean, and in fact, Obama has actually taken a stronger stand against Netanyahu than previous American presidents, but it doesn't look like Trudeau has the guts to do that.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the political configuration, do you take heart from the fact that the NDP did not vote for this? I think it was unanimous in their numbers, and the Bloc, the Green Party, and some liberals, a few liberals.
Three liberals, yeah.
Yeah. But a couple of years ago, I have the feeling they might have voted for it. What do you think?
Oh, I think that, I'm glad the NDP did it, and credit to Mulcair for doing that. But Mulcair's position on Israel is every bit as bad as the other parties. I mean, he is an ardent pro-Zionist. He tried to have Libby Davies, who we remember was a really strong supporter of Palestinian rights. He tried to have her fired by Jack Layton as House leader, and it was only through a quite a concerted campaign, partly by me, to defend her that Jack Layton backed off. No, Mulcair is certainly no better than the other leaders when it comes to the actual issues of Palestinian rights. I mean, he was essentially defending the freedom of speech, which is fine. I mean, everyone should do that. But when it comes to, he certainly won't be supporting the BDS campaign anytime soon.
No, that won't happen. I agree with you. By the way, this is Murray Dobbin, and he is, I want to remind everybody, journalist, broadcaster, author, social activist for over 40 years. And you can find Murray's writing at murraydobbin.ca. Murray, I've been wanting to ask you, and take the opportunity during this show. Are you taking some heart from the rise of Jeremy Corbyn in Britain, or are you wondering why it doesn't rub off on our NDP and
others? Well, certainly I think it's exciting to see him and then Bernie Sanders in the U.S. It's like, where the hell is Canada here? Where is our Bernie Sanders and where is our Jeremy Corbyn?
I take it as a sign of global warning that it happens there and it doesn't happen here. I don't understand.
Yeah, I don't either. No, I think the whole situation with the NDP is something else we could talk about sometime. Mm-hmm. Is really quite depressing.
Corbyn has taken these clear differences. I mean, he's supportive, sympathetic to the demands of the Palestinian people.
Absolutely.
He has not jettisoned Israel, but he clearly sees that we need a more balanced approach if we're ever going to get any progress.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the cowardice involved here is really quite stunning, because obviously, like we said earlier, all these politicians, especially at the senior level of the Prime Minister's office, they know everything we know. Mm-hmm. And so they know that when they agree to this resolution, that they are acquiescing to the Israeli lobby, and they are essentially abandoning Palestinians because they're too frightened to take on the B'nai B'rith and the Canadian Jewish Congress and other other Israeli lobby groups, and I think it's offensive, and it's really quite sad, because I've been quite impressed with some of the things that Trudeau has done so far. Mm-hmm. I mean, he has reversed some of the most outrageous things that Harper did, and so this I think is a real this is a serious blot on his record, and especially his declaration around the world that Canada is back. Well, apparently not. This is not a minor policy issue. This is a huge issue in the Middle East, and you can be sure that every Middle Eastern government and every Palestinian group will know exactly what the Trudeau government did.
Yeah, it does raise the liberal tradition of managing to have a foot in each camp. I mean, we just went through the episode with he barely got in the door when he said, well, of course we're going to go through with the sale of the tanks to Saudi Arabia that is bombing Yemen.
Right.
Because a deal's a deal.
Yeah.
So yeah. The French are not sending an aircraft carrier to Russia, I noticed.
Well, yeah, but a deal isn't a deal. The deal hasn't been signed. So that's just bullshit, and we know that. I mean, the deal is on paper, but it has not been finalized, and it's completely within the rights of a newly elected government to review a contract that hasn't been finalized and say, no, we're not going there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think they're on the wrong side of two major Middle East issues. Mm-hmm. God knows what they'll do, with Libya. Maybe we'll be, we were part of it. That's disgusting. Mm-hmm. Overthrow of Gaddafi, and we now know what the blowback from that is. A totally failed state, which it'll probably take at least a generation to recover if it does that.
If it does.
If it ever does. So yes. I mean, this is they essentially destroyed a country, mm-hmm. And we were a major part of that. And I haven't yet heard Mr. Trudeau or Dion say that was a mistake. And we're now paying the consequences, and we have to figure out some other way of dealing with so-called Arab dictatorships. Well, yeah, of course they're Arab dictatorships, because they run countries that were designed at colonial desk. France and Britain sat down and decided what the borders were going to be, and the only form of government that that actually worked in some of these places mm-hmm. Was a dictatorship. Libya is such a clear example of that.
Yeah. Maybe we have to review what we think of colonialism. I was noticing that Mr. Hollande yesterday gave the Legion of Honor to one of the princes from Saudi Arabia. And now, of course, France is a great colonial power. He doesn't see a contradiction at all.
No.
But the rest of us ought to maybe think, is that really appropriate?
Well, yeah, I mean, and I think that, the broader impact of this, of course, is just an enormous amount of cynicism on the part of citizens who actually pay attention to these things. We can't even eke out that much integrity that we would say this is an offensive resolution. It's ridiculous. This is a peaceful campaign. While we don't endorse it, we certainly see it as less of a threat to Israel than armed struggle. Mm-hmm. I mean, why would it be so hard to say that? I mean, at what price would Trudeau pay? I mean, he's in the first 6 months of a 4-year mandate.
Yes.
As if this is somehow going to hurt him.
My guess is that he would have had general support and almost a sigh of relief.
Yes.
If he refused to go along.
Exactly. I mean, and a lot of people are sort of on, he could have played a really important role. I mean, a lot of people are on the fence. They don't have a huge amount of information because the mainstream media never talks about the history of the Palestinian struggle or the formation of Israel. So most people, unless they've actually gone to the effort of researching it, very few people have a really good grasp of this. And so a lot of people are sitting on the fence because they saw the slaughter of innocents in Gaza, so they understand that. Mm-hmm. Trudeau could have made a huge difference, but no, he just decided to play the coward's card and make it go away.
Yeah. We're not surprised. Murray Daba, you write a great column. We always look forward to seeing it, and we thank you very, very much for being with us.
Oh, happy to do it.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. Yeah.
Bye-bye. Murray Daba. And it is MurrayDobbin.ca. The article is titled Justin Trudeau's Shameful Extending Carte Blanche. How about that? Blanche, pretending I could speak French, to Israel. And you will find his writing at Taï and a U.S. journal, a very great one, called Counterpunch. You're listening to CIUT. 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. By the way, you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. We encourage you to do so. I've had some letters recently. I want to tell our listeners that, yes, we are following and will be doing a report on Yemen because it's a forgotten war. And it's a situation where the richest monarchy, well, maybe after the Britain is a monarchy, so maybe they're not the richest. But anyhow, the oil-rich monarchs of Saudi Arabia are bombing the poorest country in the Middle East, Yemen, trying to bring it into submission, bring it to heel. And all they've done so far is made life miserable for the people of Yemen, but they haven't made them happy. And the people of Yemen are resisting apparently as strongly as they ever have. And we do want to keep track of that. We have to point out that you won't find it on the front page of your newspapers every day. Instead, you will find editorial writers of the Globe and the Star and elsewhere worrying themselves about whether Assad is a perfect Democrat or his Republican system, which, by the way, of course, involves women's participation at every level of Syrian society, and which has a Congress in which there are women members and people of all classes are present, and where your garb is not dictated by any state, etc. This is the one that our editorial writers are very concerned about. But meanwhile, they provide guns and planes and money and intelligence support to the royal family of Saudi Arabia so that it can more efficiently slaughter the people of Yemen. So we do need more. By the way, I have to tell you, it's not the easiest place to do some reporting on. And I've been asked about our friend and colleague, Thomas Mountain, who is in Eritrea, and we wish to get him on the air again soon. We tried recently. We don't always succeed in reaching Eritrea because it's not so simple. You have to go through operators, and it just is not as efficient. And Thomas and I have been in touch. At the very least, I will make sure that I read things from Thomas Mountain if we don't reach him. But we have a plan, a strategy to make sure that we do more coverage of Eritrea. And again, I'll remind you, you can write to us, taylor@cit.fm. And of course, we're on the web, taylor-report.com. And you should go, for example, if you went to this program, the interview with Murray Dobbin and Rick Sterling and Matthew Lee, you'll find that probably at the latter end of this week at facebook.com/TheTaylorReport. And so, again, that's probably the most efficient is facebook.com/TheTaylorReport. And I'll tell you again, because we think it's going to be a great event, David Barsamian is going to be coming on March the 20th at 12 o'clock at Hart House Debate Room, and it's sponsored by CIT. I urge you to go to CIUT.fm. You can get the tickets there. They are $30, and they are tax-deductible. Barsamian is one of the best-known veteran broadcasters who has always covered matters from a, I would say, I think his sights in anti-imperialist, anti-colonialist direction. He has been one of the people you can turn to for information on struggle against racism in America, and long distinguished record, but particularly his interviews over the years with I'll think of it in a moment. Anyway, many distinguished Noam Chomsky, pardon me. One of the ways to remember things best is not to look at your notes. If you just look at the ceiling and think of who's the most famous intellectual in North America, you'll say, out of your mouth will come the name Noam Chomsky. I think we have a little bit to go here. I want to thank Matthew Lee. And if you want to know about him, it's innercitypress.com. And he has a second site. It's called funka.info. And by the way, funka.info is a lot of fun because there's a lot of comments there by people who work at the United Nations as journalists. And, you know, you do want to always know what's the filter like that you're getting information from. And it sounds like a very toxic environment. It also sounds like there's an elite and then a substrata, and then a lower strata. There's the insiders and the outsiders. Just exactly what you would have imagined. It goes on there. And people tell interesting stories. One of them I saw was that President Morales was Bolivia, was at the UN, and one of the Bolivian journalists was in the press room at the United Nations. And so, of course, he turned to his compatriot to have the first question for the president from Bolivia. But the local press crowd, having their own little bitty rules, snagged the microphone, took it out of the person's hand, and then they asked the question because they have a club, and the Bolivian didn't belong to the club. So if you listen to the Taylor Report, you belong to the club. And I want to thank Hanny and Charlotte, and I'm Phil Taylor, and we'll see you next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Later on, critically acclaimed actress Vonnie Burrows reads from Sojourner Truth.
Ain't I a woman indeed? Well, now, women don't intend to fall into any more of your traps with Andrew Beck, attorney with the ACLU Reproductive Rights Project. Women fought to climb out of another trap dug for them on their long road for reproductive health and the control of their bodies. The deepest of traps, targeted regulation of abortion providers, known as TRAPS, laws that are cloaked in the deceptive language of women's health, but which actually put women at risk by shutting down health centers where women can get safe and legal abortions, was just argued at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court case was the most important abortion case in decades. Inside the court, the justices asked how the law will help Texas women. Meanwhile, outside, advocates gathered to demonstrate their support for abortion access for every woman in every state. Shifts in the power structure of Congress have led to promises to strip away access to reproductive health care, especially abortion.
Laws that make it difficult and not impossible for a woman to get an abortion if she needs one, particularly if she's poor, are increasing at an alarming pace. At this critical time, we'll reveal who's behind the traps and what we can expect from the Supreme Court in the wake of this latest anti-abortion case. And most importantly, on protecting access to affordable contraception, protecting a woman's ability to make a personal, private decision about pregnancy and abortion, and fighting pregnancy discrimination.
Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's begin with the Supreme Court. The trap, the targeted regulation of abortion providers. Who was behind that saw this case progress to the Supreme Court? And how do you analyze the nature of the arguments that ensued and what you think they portend for women's reproductive health self-determination?
The first thing to remember is who is not behind these laws, and that is major medical associations and doctors. From the American Medical Association to the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, every mainstream medical association has come out against these laws and said they have nothing to do with protecting women's health, and in fact, they are going to harm women if they are allowed to go into effect. The short answer to who is behind the laws is politicians. Politicians in states like Texas, but well beyond Texas as well, playing doctor, writing regulations that are designed to close abortion clinics but are masked in the language of women's health. The ideas are generated by anti-abortion think tanks in Washington, D.C., like the Americans United for Life and the National Right to Life Committee, that writes draft legislation and sends it all across the country to politicians like those in Texas and Alabama and Wisconsin and other states that have enacted cookie-cutter versions of these laws. The laws have nothing to do with protecting women's health. That's crystal clear. They're instead all about closing down abortion clinics. That brings us to the other part of your question, which is how did that play out in the Supreme Court. For those of us who care about a woman's ability to access safe and legal abortion, there were definitely some heartening moments in the court because the justices really seemed to get the idea that these laws have nothing to do with protecting women seeking an abortion, which is already one of the safest medical procedures a woman can seek in Western medicine, and is instead all about singling out abortion for unnecessary and onerous restrictions that are designed to have the effect of closing down abortion clinics. So you saw a lot of questions from the justices indicating, why have you singled out abortion here when we know, for example, that colonoscopy has a 30 times higher risk of complications? Why did you single out abortion? You can get a procedure in a dental office, has a far higher risk of complications. Again, the politicians have, with sort of a laser-like focus, singled out only abortion. And that really got under the skin of some of the justices, and you could tell in some of their questions. So for those of us who are concerned about these issues, there was a lot of optimism to take out of the argument from some of the justices' questions.
Could you go a little deeper in what exactly the Texas case was? What did Texas do to discourage abortion?
The Texas law has two parts. It falls under the category of trap laws, which are targeted regulations of abortion providers. Those are laws that single out abortion providers for unique restrictions, invoking sort of the rationale of women's health, even though they have nothing to do with women's health. And they single out abortion providers, even though they don't impose comparable restrictions on physicians providing similar forms of health care. So the two provisions at issue in the Texas case are what's called an ambulatory surgical center law that requires abortion clinics to transform themselves into miniature hospitals that are designed. Ambulatory surgical centers are meant to provide spaces where physicians are performing much, much more complicated surgical procedures than an abortion. And so it's really sort of subjecting abortion clinics to restrictions that are designed for a much more serious type of medical procedure. That's one of the provisions at issue in this case. The other provision at issue in this case is an admitting privileges requirement, which requires doctors who perform abortions, but again, no other form of outpatient health care, to obtain privileges at a hospital, which, as the drafters of these laws well knew, abortion providers just can't get. So the result, predictably, is to close down clinics. So in Texas, if these provisions had been allowed to go into effect, it would have the effect of closing down something like three-quarters of the abortion clinics in the state and forcing women to have to drive hundreds of miles in order to obtain that form of health care, creating waiting lists, delaying what is obviously a time-sensitive procedure. So those are the two provisions that were at issue in the case. And again, the justices, many of their questions zeroed in on the fact that this is singling out abortion for very onerous regulations that are not imposed on any other kind of outpatient health care.
Does this mean that now, as per Justice Kennedy, that it will be sent back to the lower courts to come up with more of a factual predicate about whether or not it's speculative or whether or not there are actual closures that will occur as a result of this regulation? I mean, where did the court leave the argument?
You've hit the nail on the head in terms of zeroing in on Justice Kennedy. As with so many issues in the Supreme Court, this case turns on Justice Kennedy, at least reading the comments that the justices made at the argument. And as is often the case, it's difficult to read the tea leaves in terms of an outcome based on the few questions that he asked. But he did ask questions that seemed to suggest that the lower court's approach, which was basically to say, so long as the state said this law was about women's health, it doesn't matter whether or not the evidence actually shows that to be true. And in fact, even though the evidence proves otherwise, if the state says it, we have to accept it. That was the lower court's approach. Some of Justice Kennedy's questions were not consistent with that lower court approach. And so one potential outcome would be to send it back to the lower courts to develop further facts. And another outcome would be to set a clear standard that rejects that lower court approach and that says when states pass laws restricting abortion in the name of protecting women's health, there has to be some evidence that shows that the restriction is actually about what the politicians have said it's about. You can't pass a law claiming to be about protecting women's health when, in fact, we know the law will, in fact, harm women.
Now, one of the things that happened in May is the House passed what we think is an unconstitutional 20-week abortion ban. Now the Senate is taking its turn, and thanks to the baseless attack campaign targeting Planned Parenthood, abortion opponents think they've kind of got momentum on their side. So it looks like they're gunning again to get a 20-week abortion ban passed as the first step in their push to end safe and legal abortion forever. Tell us about that effort and to what extent we're filled with trepidation that they really can turn the clock back for women.
I mean, that's exactly what this law would do if it were allowed to pass. And it's very important that it not pass because it would, in fact, turn back the clock.
By the way, we should say the bill is actually H.R. 36.
Correct. Again, the bill is singling out and targeting women and is patently unconstitutional. But it's also, in addition to that, incredibly insensitive to the very complicated circumstances of women who are seeking abortion. So we know that the vast majority of abortions in the United States takes place in the first trimester. But we also know that life is messy, and we never know all of a woman's circumstances, and there are many circumstances, including diagnosis of a fetal anomaly or incest or other circumstances to each individual woman's life, that cause some women to need abortion services at a time when this law would make that illegal. And we know that when abortion services aren't available, it doesn't mean that people don't obtain abortions. It means that they resort to unsafe measures. And so this is a really insensitive and very dangerous law. And we think it's very important that people take a stand, contact their legislators, and tell them how dissatisfied they are with politicians playing politics with medicine.
And what's happening with other states with regard to laws similar to the Texas law or other laws that seek to hinder women's right to have an abortion?
So there is a real onslaught at the state level. In the past 5 years, states have passed something like 290 restrictions on a woman's ability to access an abortion, which means that in the past 5 years, since 2010, states have passed nearly as many restrictions as they had in the prior 15 years combined. And in 2015 alone, states passed 60 new restrictions, and they have not let up in 2016. So the restrictions fall into a number of categories. Certainly, you know, I think at the top of the list is the trap laws similar to the Texas law we're seeing. So Texas obviously rightfully has been the focus of everyone's attention right now because it's the case before the Supreme Court. But there's litigation against comparable laws going on in six states right now. So in Alabama, Wisconsin, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Tennessee, there is ongoing litigation challenging similar laws. And all of those laws, like Texas, would have, if they were allowed to go into effect, have dramatic effects on access to abortion. But it's not just trap laws. We see laws banning abortion, whether it be at an early stage of gestation, for example, at 6 weeks, like North Dakota passed a couple years ago, or 12 weeks, like Arkansas passed, or the 20-week restriction that we were just speaking about. There are bans on abortion procedures. There are laws that are designed to shame women seeking abortion services by forcing them to wait 24 hours, 72 hours, because the implication is that they haven't thought long and hard enough already, and that they're supposed to make two trips to the abortion clinic and think a little harder before they're able to obtain health care. So those are some of the examples of the laws we're seeing introduced around the country. But it's a real onslaught that's really picked up ever since 2010.
And, of course, there's the issue of contraception that is certainly not faring very much better. And I want you to talk a bit about what is happening. We certainly are familiar with the Hobby Lobby case and what that meant for contraception for women. And after you do that, got to shift gears radically and talk about the fight back, lest I leave here in a state of abject depression and do fall into one of those many traps that have been set for us. And of course, there's splendid, remarkable work, because every one of the cases, from Kentucky to Florida to Texas and so on to Maine, the ACLU has been on the case, as well as other organizations from the progressive legal community who do fight ceaselessly for women's reproductive health and self-determination. So we don't want people to leave here with too many pains, but we definitely want them to tell the Senate, the politicians who aren't medical experts and must not be allowed to interfere in a woman's medical decisions, to reject H.R. 36. But having said that, tell us a little bit about what's up on the contraceptive front and what we need to do to not fall into those traps.
Definitely. Starting with the contraceptive rule case, this is a case, sort of an extension of the Hobby Lobby case, but as everyone likely knows, the federal contraception rule is part of the Affordable Care Act. It was a regulation that was promulgated under the Affordable Care Act, and it requires health insurance coverage for a host of women's health issues, including domestic violence screening and prenatal care. And so as a result of the contraception rule, insurance plans have to include all FDA-approved contraception without a copay or deductible. And there is an accommodation in the law, which is what is now at issue in the new case called Zubik. Under the accommodation, if a religiously affiliated nonprofit has a religious objection to covering contraception, they're accommodated. The employer doesn't have to provide contraception or insurance that provides contraception. They simply have to fill out a form saying they object to it and send it to their insurance company or to the federal government. And what is at issue in this case is whether or not simply having to fill out that form amounts to a substantial burden on the religious exercise rights of these nonprofit corporations. The interesting thing with Hobby Lobby is Hobby Lobby looked to that accommodation and said, that's sort of the basis of the rationale that the Supreme Court used in ruling in favor of Hobby Lobby in the prior case. So it's a little ironic for the employers now to come back and say, no, that isn't good enough, and that imposing a substantial burden on our religious exercise. So that is the nature of the challenge before the court. It will be heard in the Supreme Court later this month. What this case is really about is discrimination against women, with employers trying to use religion to block their employees' coverage for contraceptive health care. So we will see how that plays out. But to transition to your final plea, which is, you know, what basis for optimism do we have here? I mean, I think this is – it's a challenging time, but it's also a very exciting time in the sense that I think a lot of folks are galvanized. And it's not just the organizations that have been fighting in court, but – people who are watching the Supreme Court, seeing what's at stake with, you know, how far extreme politicians are going, I think people are galvanized by the attention that this is getting. And so you saw people, you know, for example, in the amicus briefs in the Supreme Court on the Texas case, you know, whether it was people in business or people, lawyers or other people in other walks of life, filing amicus briefs and saying, you know, what the lawyer's brief started out with a quote from a lawyer who said, I'm a lawyer who had an abortion, but I'm also a lawyer because I had an abortion, and really sort of speaking out on the importance of the ability to access safe and legal abortion and what that means for women's lives. And I think there is a sense, you know, I have to be an optimist to be able to work in this line of work, but I think this is a time when it is very exciting because you are seeing a sense that this is something that is resonating with people. It's important for folks to reach out to their congressmen and, frankly, their state politicians as well, because these laws are being passed at the state level. That's where the greatest number of restrictions are coming from. And I think this is a moment where we can really take advantage of the outrage that people feel over these sham charade laws that are passed purported, you know, for one reason. They, you know, the politicians say one thing, but we all know it's about something else. And I think that that's really getting under people's skin. And so I take from this sort of a positive moment where people are really galvanized and motivated.
Well, you've lifted my spirits. And, of course, we understand that so much of this affects poor women, women of color. Thank you for your astute analysis, Andrew Beck, attorney with the ACLU Reproductive Rights Project, and a special good Women's History Month. Let's listen to Ann Feeney.
That man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages, lifted over mud puddles, and have the best place everywhere. Ain't no man ever lifted me into carriages or helped me over mud puddles, and I ain't never had the best place anywhere. Ain't I a woman?
Woman.
Ain't I a woman?
Ain't I a woman?
Look at me.
In the town of Akron, Ohio, in the year 1851, an African-American woman delivered a moving speech at the Women's Convention that would be remembered for its rawness, its authenticity, and its powerful message that holds as much relevance today as it did then. Sojourner Truth spoke to the Women's Convention about her experiences and tribulations, not only as a woman in that day's society, but as a black woman. She established a sense of identity as a victim of discrimination by describing how she faced prejudices as a black person and as a woman in order to incite an emotional response in her audience. And she invited that audience, mostly women, who experienced suffering from their own forms of discrimination, to realize the injustices of which they too are victims. And we're going to listen to actress Viney Burroughs, who is going to be featured reading Sojourner Truth's Ain't I a Woman.
Thank you, all of you who are standing out there. And it is really wonderful to look around and see the young people, to see the older people, to see the local construction workers, local, their women's committee is out here in force. We should congratulate the Women's Day Coalition for putting together this event. We're here because on August the 26th, 1920, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified and ostensibly gave women the right to vote. Well, a previous speaker talked about the omissions when it said women were given the right to vote, because it meant that black women, Native American women, were not given the right to vote. Congress ratified the women's right to vote because women struggled. Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without demand, without struggle. What we want, we have to struggle for. I want us today to also honor a woman warrior, a freedom fighter, African woman, Sojourner Truth. Let me hear it for Sojourner Truth. Say her name again. Once it was Sojourner's rage against the brutality of chattel slavery, against the oppression of women, that spurred what finally became the 19th Amendment. And it is in the spirit of Sojourner Truth which animates today our Black Lives Matter, our Give the Palestinians a State Matter, the End Police Terror Matter, End Fracking, Protect the Voting Rights Act. Let's call her name again once more out loud. She was born in Ulster County, New York State, near the end of the 18th century. She was the so-called property of Dutch settlers. She was given the name Isabella Bumfrey. When slavery was abolished in New York State, Isabella Bumfrey decided to get rid of her slave name. You see, Malcolm wasn't the first one to do it. And she took as her new name Sojourner, because she was going to sojourn, travel all over the United States, and she was going to speak out against slavery, and she was going to speak up for women's rights. And since she said everybody has a last name, she chose Truth, because she was going to preach the truth about the brutality, the inhumanity of slavery, and the oppression of women by men. Now I'm going to give you a speech that Sojourner gave at a women's rights convention in Akron, Ohio. She had not been invited to the convention, and when she got there, they didn't want her to speak, because the lady said, there is absolutely no connection between women's rights and slave rights. So Sojourner waited, seated in the auditorium, and when there was a lull in the proceedings, she got out of her seat, walked down the aisle, stepped up to the platform and said, well, children, where there's so much racket, there must be something out of kilter. Now, I think that twixt the colored people in the South and the women in the North, all shouting about their rights, the white man gonna be in a hell of a fix pretty soon. But what all this here shouting about? Well, one man say, women need to be lifted into carriages and helped over mud puddle and have the best place everywhere. Well, nobody ever lift me into a carriage or help me over a mud puddle or give me the best place anywhere. And ain't I a woman? Look at my arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered into barns, and no man could head me. I could work as much and eat as much as any man when I could get it, and bear the lash as well. And ain't I a woman? I have birthed 5 children, and I seen all my children sold off into slavery. And when I cried out with a mother's grief, there was nobody, nobody but Jesus to hear me. Ain't I a woman? All right now. They talk about something in the head. What that they call it? Help me out, children. Intellect, that's it, honey. What intellect got to do with women's rights or colored folks' rights? If my cup don't hold but 1 pint and your cup hold 1 quart, wouldn't you be mean not to let me have my little half measure full? Now, the preacher man said that woman can't have as much rights as men because Christ want a man. Well, where your Christ come from? He come from God, and a woman, man had nothing to do with him. Now, if the first woman that God ever made was strong enough to turn the whole world upside down all by herself, then these women all together ought to be able to set it right side up again. And now they is asking to do it, the men had better let them. Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
The writings of the world.
I want to dedicate
dedicate this to the LGBT community all around the world.
Born in Lancashire, England in 1939, his fascination with acting was encouraged early on by his parents.
Our very existence troubles the binary. I think that's wonderful for society. But every single day, an intersex baby is undergoing a human rights violation.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A backdoor marriage equality ban fails in Switzerland. Singer Sam Smith wins Razzies for his history-free Oscars homage. And writer-activist Ida Valoria introduces Intersex 101. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending March 5th, 2016. Swiss voters narrowly rejected proposed constitutional changes this week that would have made civil marriage equality virtually impossible in the tiny Central European nation. The initiative, pushed by the centrist Christian Democratic People's Party and entitled For Marriage and Family Against the Penalty of Marriage, would have reduced the tax burden for married couples who must file jointly in Switzerland rather than as individuals, but it would have also defined civil marriage as exclusively heterosexual. Slightly less than 51% voted against the proposal in the February 28th referendum, while a little more than 49% voted in favor. According to local media, turnout at the polls was 63%, the highest in more than 20 years. Switzerland currently only allows civil partnerships. Breathing a sigh of relief, LGBT rights activists condemned the stealth effort to roadblock civil marriage equality for gay and lesbian couples. Bastian Bowman of the advocacy organization Pink Cross told the Swiss news agency that, "We are glad that the electorate has recognized this sham."
The European Court of Human Rights ruled this week that the principle of family reunification requires countries to allow the foreign partners of lesbian and gay people to immigrate to their spouse's country of residence. Under that principle, the presence of one or more family members in a certain country enables the rest of the family to immigrate to that country as well. According to the Pink News website, the case was brought by a woman from Bosnia-Herzegovina who was refused a Croatian residence permit after asking to be reunited with her Croatian partner. The women had been in a stable relationship for 2 years, but neither country recognizes same-gender relationships. The Strasbourg-based court ruled that the denial violated non-discrimination, privacy, and family life rights guaranteed by the European Convention on Human Rights. It affects all 47 Council of Europe nations that have signed on to the convention. Scottish member of the European Parliament Alan Smith joined equality activists in celebrating the unanimous ruling. "Everyone has a right to family life and to be with his or her loved ones," he said. "Immigration cases must not be decided based on someone's sexual orientation."
Bermuda's Royal Gazette newspaper reported this week that the North Atlantic Island Nation's government is planning a public vote on civil marriage equality. Premier Michael Dunkley told a media conference that a referendum bill will be introduced in the House of Assembly this legislative session. The announcement came moments after Patricia Gordon Pamplin, Minister for Community, Culture and Sports, introduced the Civil Union Bill 2016 in that chamber. She noted that civil marriage equality and civil unions were at the forefront of our national conversation, as evidenced by passionate debate on all sides of the issue in a series of recent public consultations. The government moves came on February 29th, the same day that a landmark Bermuda Supreme Court ruling took effect, allowing foreign same-gender partners of Bermudians in permanent relationships to live and work in the British Overseas Territory, a right given automatically to married heterosexual couples. Premier Dunkley also said that his government is of the view that marriage is a union between a man and a woman, which is why we have also introduced in the House the Matrimonial Causes Amendment Act 2016, which will strengthen that act. Bermuda's Human Rights Commission said that it was bitterly disappointed by the government's actions, adding in a media statement that, We specifically reject the notion that the opinion of the majority should impinge on the right of equal treatment for minorities. All people deserve to be treated equally under the law.
The U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or EEOC, filed its first-ever lawsuits this week against companies charged with discriminating against gay and lesbian employees. The commission decided last year that those workers could claim sexual orientation discrimination as sex discrimination violations of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. U.S. federal law currently fails to protect sexual minorities from any form of discrimination. But last year's decision, covering companies with 15 or more workers, prompted the two employment discrimination lawsuits this week. One suit details the constant harassment of a Pennsylvania gay man that forced him to resign. It included name-calling by his manager and crude comments about his sexuality by fellow employees. His complaints to upper management were allegedly ignored. The second details the constant verbal harassment of a Maryland lesbian, including a supervisor informing her that he wanted to turn you back into a woman and telling her she would look good in a dress. When she complained to management, she was fired. EEOC General Counsel David Lopez said in a statement that with the filing of the two lawsuits on March 1st, the commission is continuing to solidify its commitment to ensuring that individuals are not discriminated against in workplaces because of their sexual orientation. While some federal courts have begun to recognize this right under Title VII, it is critical that all courts do so.
In other news, lawmakers in South Dakota failed to override the veto by Republican Governor Dennis Daugaard of a controversial bill that would have required transgender school students to use the bathrooms and other campus facilities of their birth gender rather than the gender with which they identify. The first in the U.S. proposal had drawn nationwide scrutiny, and the conservative Daugaard no doubt felt an uncomfortable spotlight. He said in his veto message that the issue was better left to local school boards. Proponents were unable to gather the required two-thirds vote in the House to override the veto, which the governor issued just hours before the bill would have become law without his signature. He took his time to make a decision, including meeting with transgender students. Michael Silverman of the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund applauded the governor's action. Transgender young people already face extraordinarily high rates of bullying in school, he said. And this bill would have made them targets for further harassment. Similar proposals are being considered in a number of other states.
The state body in Texas that oversees high school sports initiated a requirement this week that was approved by an overwhelming number of school superintendents that officials use a birth certificate to determine a student-athlete's gender. University Interscholastic League spokesperson Jamie Harrison told the Dallas Morning News that the agency had been approached by an increasing number of school officials for guidance on the matter, and that was the recommendation we gave them. The policy does allow other government documents to be used for the purpose of identification if a birth certificate is not available. Chris Mosier, the founder of TransAthlete.com, told the Texas Observer that the move denies transgender athletes an equal opportunity to sports. At the high school level, we should be encouraging participation for all students. Lawsuits challenging the policy are all but certain.
Despite a growing wave of bills purporting to protect religious freedom, the West Virginia Senate this week soundly defeated a proposal that would have made it legal for businesses and individuals to discriminate against gay people based on sincerely held religious belief. The Religious Freedom Protection Act had sailed through the House by a vote of 72 to 26, but senators voted 27 to 7 against it. A number of the state's leading business officials and prominent residents had come out strongly against the bill.
A similar proposal, called the First Amendment Defense Act, has been denounced by major businesses in Georgia. It's already passed in one chamber of the legislature, but Democrat-turned-Republican Governor Nathan Deal added his voice to the opposition this week, vowing to reject any measure that allows discrimination in our state in order to protect people of faith. He urged religious conservatives not to feel threatened by last year's Supreme Court marriage equality ruling, which many believe has spawned the spate of so-called religious liberty and anti-trans bills across the United States. Deal also called on his fellow Republicans pushing for the measure to take a deep breath and recognize that the world is changing around us.
And finally,
I'm changing my major to Joan. I'm changing my major to sex with Joan.
It's not clear if all of the 17 United Nations ambassadors knew what the Tony Award-winning Broadway musical Fun Home was about before they saw it, but they were guests of U.S. Envoy Samantha Power at a performance this week. Fun Home is based on the semi-autobiographical graphic novels of lesbian feminist writer Alison Bechdel that also portrays her closeted gay father. It's not known what Russia's ambassador Vitaly Churkin thought of it. His is one of 76 countries that, according to a 2015 UN report, have laws criminalizing LGBT people. He was among UN ambassadors from Australia, Gabon, Mexico, Namibia, Norway, Uruguay, and Vietnam, who also took in the show. Ambassador Power has been a strong advocate for LGBT equality in the world body. She told reporters that she invited the diverse group of ambassadors to see the stories of real lives to underscore the challenges that LGBT people face every day around the world. The play dramatizes the issues in a way that UN resolutions and statements never can, she said. Switzerland's Ambassador Jörg Lauber agreed. Too often our work is about abstracts, he said. Once in a while, it's important to tell us it's about people.
That's News Wrap for the week ending March 5th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm John Dyer V.
Something Sir Ian actually said, and a crash course about the eye for the many folks who simply don't know, later in the program.
I've been here before, but always hit the floor. I've spent a lifetime running, and I always get away. But with you, I'm feeling something that makes me want to stay.
That was singer-songwriter Sam Smith at the Motion Picture Academy's Big Show performing the Best Original Song nominated tune he penned with Jimmy Napes for the James Bond movie Spectre. Smith started the night on February 28th as an Oscar hopeful, but after The Writings on the Wall took the trophy, he turned himself into an Oscar controversy with an error-encumbered acceptance speech and fallacious follow-ups.
I actually can't breathe right now. Oh, my gosh. Thank you to this man here, Jimmy Napes. To all the nominees, you're incredible. Gaga, you're incredible. I read an article a few months ago by Sir Ian McKellen, and he said that no openly gay man had ever won an Oscar. And if this is the case, even if it isn't the case, I want to dedicate this to the LGBT community all around the world. I stand here tonight as a proud gay man, and I hope we can all stand together as equals one day. Thank you so much.
You can take Sam Smith's word that he's a proud gay man, and indeed Lady Gaga's Oscar night performance was an emotional showstopper. However, Smith misquoted Sir Ian McKellen. The venerable actor was talking specifically about the absence of a gay Best Actor winner at the Oscars. Smith was rather harshly criticized in the press and the Twitterverse, where lots of previous queer Oscar winners were offered. When he was told about two-time out Best Song winner Howard Ashman, Smith dug his hole deeper by joking that they should date, unaware that Ashman died from complications of AIDS in 1991. So if you plan to honor the community when you win your Oscar, better brush up on your queer history first.
It's time for Who Said That? On this episode of The Rainbow Minute. Born in Lancashire, England in 1939, his fascination with acting was encouraged early on by his parents. Becoming a leading British actor of his time, his legendary Shakespearean performances and his leading roles in blockbuster films earned more than 40 major international acting awards. He is best known for his roles as Wizard Gandalf in Lord of the Rings and as Magneto in the X-Men trilogy. He came out in 1988 on BBC Radio and has been a prominent campaigner for gay equality. He once said, "When you come out, you change. Utterly. You are, for the first time, yourself. And what has an actor got to use on stage but himself?" Who said that? It was Sir Ian McKellen, one of the world's most highly regarded actors. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Dustin Richardson.
Got a sweet tooth, licorice drops and jelly roll. Hey, sugar daddy, Hansel needs some sugar in his bowl.
Hi, this is John Cameron Mitchell, the writer-director of Hedwig and the Angry Inch and Short Bus. And you're listening to This Way Out, the international weekly radio magazine for all our sexually diverse communities.
The song may be satirical, but the situation is real for intersex people. This Way Out correspondent Vosh Bodhi breaks through the ignorance of the I in LGBTQI with writer-activist Hita Valoria.
Tell me how you identify yourself.
I identify as a Latina intersex woman and writer, activist, human rights activist. And the word in that little phrase that probably most people aren't familiar with is intersex.
What is intersex?
Intersex people are born with, or sometimes develop in puberty, variations in biological sex. And that can look many different ways. It can be someone like me who's born with ambiguous genitals, or it can be people who are born with completely typical bodies but have a different chromosomal makeup that is not typical. There are variations such as XXY, XYY. There's people who are born with XY chromosomes, which are typically male, but look externally just like any other women. So they are labeled and raised as female, as you know, one would think, because why would you label someone who looked female anything else? And yet, by the technical definition, having internal testes and XY chromosomes, they are not female by the technical definition. So we really make up a wide range of people who look very feminine, very masculine, and everywhere in between. So it's kind of impossible to lump us all together in a way. But what we do have in common is that we have sex traits which are different, and this is the reason that we are discriminated against.
Back in 2006, this community that you're talking about was defined as having disorders of sexual development.
I think the intention actually of that label is to ease parental discomfort with the idea that their child is intersex, which had implications with implied androgyny. It had associations with the LGBT community at that point. And so the idea was that this label would be preferable for parents. However, there have been major difficulties with the label. For example, I know one woman who started receiving medical treatment and being exposed to this label. And after growing up, you know, with a fairly healthy self-esteem, she just kept hearing herself referred to as a disorder. And she eventually ended up opting for surgery when she actually wouldn't have otherwise, and now deeply regrets it. But she internalized this view of herself as having something wrong with her body. And I think that is what's deeply problematic. That, and also the fact that while it may ease parental discomfort, it also facilitates the infant genital surgeries, which are typically called normalizing surgeries. And they are recommended in order to make our bodies more typically male or female. And everyone that I've spoken to, and there's just dozens of reports from adults who received these surgeries of how harmful they were. They are, in fact, very similar when they're done to intersex women like myself who have ambiguous genitals. They're the same surgeries that are now banned in the U.S. as female genital mutilation. And they often leave women anorgasmic. If not completely anorgasmic, they definitely decrease sexual pleasure. And not just that, they also leave people feeling scarred and as if something is wrong with them. You know, how can my parents do this? There must be something wrong with me if I need to endure this. So all advocates agree that we want these surgeries to end. We want to have the right to choose for ourselves whether or not we want to do anything to our bodies. But having us officially labeled as a disorder actually makes it possible for parents who aren't wealthy and need medical coverage to get coverage for this non-medically necessary procedure of these surgeries. So it's, in effect, facilitating the surgeries. The real problem that society has is with people that break sex and gender norms. And that's why when it's detectable at birth, we often suffer. In Western nations, we are very often operated on in some way or receive some treatment, which we did not request. And sometimes this is even sex reassignment at birth. So if an intersex boy is deemed to have a penis that's going to be too small to grow up to be a happy boy, he is actually given a sex change that he didn't ask for at birth. Yeah. And the men I know that underwent this, they are all horrified, and they all actually went back to living as men. They got castrated, they got shot up with hormones, and they were forced to try to live as a girl. They were given girls' names, and, you know, the parents are encouraged to give them very strong gendering as women. And yet they go back to being men because that's what they felt inside all along. Fortunately, because of how humanity is evolving to understand and embrace diversity rather than try to eliminate it, that's really helping us. Mm-hmm. In the past, when I first started speaking about this, I'd get a lot of like, well, do the surgeries help? Or it would be so hard to be this way. And now, actually, I rarely hear that at all. I hear people more often say, oh my God, why would people do that? Why would you operate on an infant's genitals? You don't even know what they're going to grow up to be. And that shift in mentality is a result of people really learning to recognize that we're all diverse. You know, you don't know what someone is going to grow up into. So let them grow up and decide for themselves.
This is Vosh Bodhi talking with intersex person and activist Hita Valoria.
The reason I want to really be clear is, since I am an advocate for the intersex community, it's really lovely to look at the way that our very existence troubles the binary. I think that's wonderful for society. But what we sadly experience way too often is professors teaching about intersex people, and yet they don't even mention the fact that right now, every single day, an intersex baby is undergoing a human rights violation.
The intersex community got together and did what?
We published a statement. It's just simply called the Statement by the Third International Intersex Forum. And it is a statement of our demands as a community. It's telling the world this is what we want. And it is compiled by 30 intersex advocacy organizations from every continent in the world, except Antarctica. And so this is really a consensus statement on what intersex advocates want, what the community as a whole agrees that we want and need.
Why don't you tell me some of the salient points within this statement?
Well, the first one is to put an end to mutilating and normalizing practices such as genital surgeries, psychological and other medical treatments through legislative and other means. So just like female genital mutilation was banned, we want intersex genital mutilation to be banned as well. That should not be something that ever happens non-consensually, period. The second thing is to put an end to pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, prenatal screening and treatment, and selective abortion of intersex fetuses. There's also these prenatal drug treatments that are harmful both to the mother and the infant, and those are still going on. It's a drug called dexamethasone, or DEX, D-E-X. There's a lot written on that, which is great. That needs to end as well. And then put an end to infanticides and killing of intersex people. I know I see your face of shock. Oh, and the last one that I think is really important is that as a community, we agree that we need to depathologize intersex variations. In other words, no more disorders of sex development, or DSD, as it's known. That is harmful. It portrays us as inherently inferior. It's been done to the other members of the LGBTI community, as we know, right? Homosexuality used to be a psychosexual disorder. Trans used to be gender identity disorder. And we are still currently a disorder. And we want that to end as well. Those are the main things. We basically just want equal human rights.
Absolutely.
I understand, and many others understand, we're in this for the long haul. It's a process, but it's happening, and that's where we're going.
How do people get in touch with you?
OII-USA.org. That is the organization. There is a pamphlet called Brief Guidelines for Intersex Allies available on the website, OII-USA.org, and also one called Your Beautiful Child Information for Parents. Both are wonderful resources, whether you're a parent or just someone who wants to be an ally, to really get educated and learn how to spread the word.
Gita Valoria was interviewed by Vash Bodhi. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Tanya Kane Perry, John Dyer V, Judd Proctor, and Brian Burns with Dustin Richardson, and Vash Bodhi contributed program material, with double thanks this week to Steve Pride. Sam Smith, John Cameron Mitchell, and David Bowie performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson, composer, performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, a video teaser for our special From Outlaws to In-Laws CD, and even more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Arisha Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KCSB Santa Barbara, California, WMNF Tampa, Florida, Gay SA Radio Pretoria, South Africa, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all going to stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
today on Against the Grain. If global poverty is a problem for security, the question becomes whose security? The security of acutely poor people around the globe, or the security of elites, of political leaders and the upper class? I'm CS. Akhil Gupta traces fundamental shifts in the ways poverty and security have been viewed and discussed, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Poverty is a problem for the poor. That's uncontroversial. People suffer because they are poor. But what if poverty, global poverty, is seen less as a problem for the poor than as a problem for the rich? What if elites in the wealthy nations see global poverty as a problem, as a threat to them, to their health and well-being? Unchecked migration, terrorism, and disease vectors are seen in elite circles as some of the principal manifestations of that threat. Akhil Gupta has studied and written about how discourses of poverty and security have come together in ways that make meaningful poverty alleviation less rather than more likely. He also calls into question the dichotomy of global north versus global south, in light of what he sees as the changing geographies of poverty in our neoliberal capitalist era. Akhil Gupta is professor of anthropology at UCLA, where he directs the Center for India and South Asia. He contributed an essay entitled, "Is Poverty a Global Security Threat?" to the new volume, "Territories of Poverty, Rethinking North and South." When Akhil joined me from a studio at UCLA, I asked him whether national security was the main way in which security was conceptualized during the Cold War.
Yes, this was actually the primary way in which security was understood. It was understood in terms of national security. And what I try to show is that something changes in the way that security comes to be defined after the end of the Cold War.
So what did the end of the Cold War do to the ways that security was thought about in academic and policy circles?
The end of the Cold War basically caused people to rethink what security might mean, because the idea was that during the Cold War, there was a clearly defined enemy, and national security meant protecting the nation state against that enemy, which was also defined in national state terms. After the end of the Cold War, the question was, well, if we no longer have this enemy who is going to destroy us or is threatening to destroy us, then how do we think about security and how do we think about national security? And in particular, there arose the discourse after the end of the Cold War that all the resources that were being spent on the Cold War now could be used for positive social change. And this was the idea of the peace dividend. So at this time, there arose the idea that, well, security couldn't just be thought of in terms of national security, arms control, the nuclear threat, those kinds of issues, but had to, especially with the changes in the climate and with environmental destruction becoming a top order priority, the idea that you had to think about security in environmental terms, in human terms, and you had to think of the security of people and citizens within a nation state and not just the entity of the nation state itself.
Yeah, you're right that guaranteeing the security of the state, of the nation state, didn't necessarily mean safeguarding the security of its people, right, who might in fact be harmed by the policies of the nation in which they live.
Yes. So if, for example, you had totalitarian regimes or ethnically divided nation states in which one faction was in control of the nation state and used the resources of the nation state to wage war on the other faction or on ethnic minorities, then that was a situation in which some people in the nation state were acutely insecure, yet the discourse of national security actually didn't do anything for them. It didn't help think about their vulnerability in those conditions.
Now, in the 1990s, you note that there was a shift in poverty discourse to human security. There was a move from the language of human development to human security. In what ways did a report issued by the UN Development Program, I think it was in 1994, mark or effect this shift?
The 1994 report by the Human Development Report, which was edited and shepherded by Mehbub al-Haq, the economist who first gave us the idea of human development, marked a shift in the language that was used for human development towards a notion of human insecurity, human security. And the argument was that to focus on human security would basically narrow in some ways the idea of human development, and it would focus on the issues that most needed to be focused on, which is the vulnerability, the extremely vulnerable parts of the population, and the causes, the reasons why they became so vulnerable to various risks.
And what was wrong with human development, the term that had been used? How was it seen to be inadequate to this particular task?
So the idea was that human development was a very wide-ranging term. It included, for example, the idea that various kinds of potentialities of people needed to be included in the idea of human development, whereas human security focused on those things that made people particularly vulnerable, that threatened their life in some way. And so it was much more things that mattered immediately and directly to the population.
I see. And so, for example, maybe human development would encompass the right to education or educational services of a certain level, whereas human security might focus more on food and very basic necessities for survival?
That's right. And alongside that was also included the idea that food, shelter, clothing, medical aid, things that were absolutely necessary for survival were given top priority, but also things like, you know, violence that came from in the form of ethnic conflict or genocide or sexual violence. All of those things were also threats to human security. So the idea of human security combined some parts of the agenda of human development with human rights and with security issues.
What you are saying about maybe the advantages of using the term and the concept human security in place of human development, were the strength of these arguments enough to convince people to come on board with this concept, or were there other reasons why this concept caught on?
I think the main reason that the concept caught on, and it did catch on extremely fast. So once the idea of human security was proposed, it was actually taken up by a whole range of international actors. It became used, for example, in the campaign against landmines. It was part of various international institutions. It was adopted by various international institutions. And it caught something of the moment. And I think the context was ripe for this kind of idea. And once it was introduced, it quickly became a kind of mainstream concept.
And you're right that it was also vague enough, the concept of human security, that different actors could mobilize around it.
Yes. So that is a very important property, actually, of any idea that becomes a big idea like global poverty. If it's too precise, then it is also limited. But if different people can support it And they might mean different things by it. They may not mean the same thing. But if they can support it for their own reasons, and there is enough convergence in their meaning and the meaning of other actors, then it catches on and it becomes like this boundary concept that crosses over from one domain of ideas to another. And so that's exactly what human security did.
Akhil Gupta joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. He is professor of anthropology at UCLA, where he also directs the Center for India and South Asia. So we've been talking about the shift from national security to thinking about the security of the people within a nation state. We've talked about the shift in certain circles from the language of human development to human security. You also trace in this article in the volume Territories of Poverty, you also trace global poverty as a term and a concept. How long has this term been around, and when did it gain prominence?
When I first started my academic career, which was in the late 70s and early 80s, I almost never heard the term global poverty. Very few people were talking about global poverty. Global poverty became an important term after globalization became an important phenomenon. So in the sense that, and I don't mean globalization as a phenomenon, but the discourse about globalization. So when in the late 80s and early 90s, you see the rise of globalization as both a promise and a problem for the world. And it becomes part of the discourse of businesses and governments and academic work. It's at that time, only after that, that you see the rise of global poverty as a phenomenon. And so what I did was I just, in a very rough manner, I traced how many references there were to the term global poverty in popular magazines and newspapers, etc. And what I found was that after about 1999, this term suddenly becomes much more high profile and starts being used in a lot of different places. So before that, you do get the term global poverty, but it's not a concept that has very much currency.
And what accounts for the term's emergence on a rather large scale?
Part of the reason why the term global poverty becomes so popular is, again, it's a term that can mean different things to different people. It's also correlated very strongly with global inequality. So once you get globalization and growing global inequalities that result from globalization. By global inequality, I mean not just inequality between the global north and the global south, but also inequality within the global north and the global south. So you get growing inequalities within nation states. And it's at that time that you see the rise of the term global poverty.
Interestingly, you write that global poverty refers to a depoliticized concern with acute poverty, with poverty around the world. Why depoliticized?
So when poverty was a problem for nation states, and before you get the rise of global poverty, you have a lot that is said and policy discourse about poverty, but it was always in the context of nation states. So when you get the rise of global poverty as a problem facing the world, basically what that says is that all the poor people in the world can be put together in the same category. That once we invent a category of the globally poor and we define it as $1 a day, people who live for under $1 a day or people who live under $2 a day, that there is some reason why we should actually classify people and include them in this category of people who live under $1 a day. Now, it turns out that people who live under $1 a day in different parts of the world are poor because of very different reasons. They're not poor for the same reasons. And in fact, it's a very bad measure of poverty to begin with. People who live under $1 a day may actually have many different living standards, but that is not captured by the idea of a certain benchmark that you use, because obviously costs of living are very different in different countries and purchasing power is very different. So in some countries, $1 might get you quite a lot. In other countries, it might get you nothing at all. And so it's a very bad measure. But more than that, it includes people who are poor because, you know, for example, of the ill effects of colonialism on their countries, and people who are poor because of inequality in their countries. And those two might be very different sets of people. There might be very different reasons why they're poor. It includes the urban poor with the rural poor. So it basically treats everybody who's poor as abject classificatory bundle. And it makes them the objects of aid and charity. But it doesn't in any way illuminate the reasons why they are poor to begin with.
Now, could that disadvantage be made up by the fact that, as you write, you know, calls to address global poverty became very strong, especially by the mid-2000s, the decade of the noughts. So at least by, you know, you're lumping people together, you're simplifying a problem, you're not offering any context for poverty as it exists in different regions, in different nations, but at least people can rally around the term and maybe do more in relation to it than if that term had not been made so prominent?
Yes, absolutely. Global poverty is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it does exactly what you're suggesting. It rallies people to a cause, and it basically identifies a problem that everybody can get behind. But it's mainly in the context of increasing the amount of aid that is going to the very poor. So that's the context in which it's a positive step. It's not very positive in that it evades the reasons, it basically evades an analysis of the reasons why people are poor in different places in the world. And to that extent, it inhibits the ability to actually combat that poverty, because it doesn't ask the main question it doesn't ask is the question of global inequality. And you have to see it in the context of globalization. At the very time that free trade agreements are being pushed relentlessly, and at the very time that, in fact, global inequality is growing rapidly, that's the time when you see ideas about global poverty becoming very prominent.
Was there also something problematic about global poverty discourse arising in a context of neoliberalism and neoliberal capitalism and global commodity markets? In other words, did global poverty discourse tend to look for solutions in the realm of existing political economic systems that may not in fact help the poor or may not in fact be able to help the poor?
That's exactly right. So what you get is the effort on the one hand to push with neoliberal reforms, market solutions, etc. And then, of course, that creates greater inequality and it pushes a lot of people into poverty. For example, you know, a well-known side effect of NAFTA is that a lot of small peasant producers in Mexico went out of business because they could no longer afford to grow corn. And then once those people have been thrown out of jobs or out of occupations, they no longer have the means to support themselves, then they are part of the global poor. And then you try to solve the problem of their poverty by giving them aid or other such things. To the extent that it did result in more aid being given to the poor, that was good. But much of that, I would argue, was actually caused by the very solutions that many of these leaders who were campaigning against global poverty, that many of these leaders had in fact created the conditions that led to poverty in the first place.
And who are some of those leaders?
I mean, the leaders of the global north is what I would say. Tony Blair was one of them. And the people like Jeff Sachs in the U.S. whose idea about global poverty made it to the cover of Time magazine. So there are thought leaders and there are political leaders and there are policy leaders who are in charge of global development. And it was that whole consortium of people who in the 80s and 90s had relentlessly pushed market-based solutions for development. And those market-based solutions had, in fact, created global inequalities and inequalities within countries that often ended up pushing people who were middle class or lower middle class into poverty.
And so you write that the advocates of this concept, global poverty, did not see poverty as being created by global or structural inequalities. I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And Akhil Gupta joins us. He teaches anthropology at UCLA. His books include Red Tape, Bureaucracy, Structural Violence, and Poverty in India, and Postcolonial Developments, Agriculture and the Making of Modern India. And he wrote an essay called Is Poverty a Global Security Threat?, which is part of the new volume, Territories of Poverty, Rethinking North and South. We have links to Akhil and his work on our website, againstthegrain.org. So earlier you were telling me about the emergence of this concept of human security, which focused, unlike maybe human development, focused more on the basic needs of people, their need to survive, their need not to be confronted with violence or hunger. And you write that the subject of security, that is, the people whose security was to be emphasized, changed after 9/11. But let's start with before 9/11. So before 9/11, we have this discourse of human security. Who were the subjects of security in the minds of people who thought these thoughts?
So human security was concerned with poor people, right? So the idea was that we are worried about the security of the very poor, and human security draws attention to the provision of goods and services to the poor, but also to other aspects that basically threatened their lives and their livelihoods. So when I say the subject of human security, what I mean is, when I talked about how the subject has changed, what I mean is that the term, whom does the term refer to, right? So human security was unambiguously referred to very poor people, mostly in the global south.
Okay, well, that makes good sense. And then what happens to the focus or the target or the agent of security after 9/11 and why?
So this is a very interesting question. After 9/11, what happens is that the idea of human security changes so that the documents and the discourse after 9/11, which is emphasizing human security, takes this idea that human security is mainly a problem for poor people in the global south and changes it to mean that human security is our security. It's the security of all of us. And the us is never stated. Who is this us? But this is what I mean by the subject of security discourse. But the us whose security is to be secured becomes the elite in the global north.
The elite in the global north now has to be made secure. That's then the focus of human security discourse?
That is what happens after 9/11, because the idea is that suddenly we are all vulnerable to terrorism, that it can strike at any time. So before the nation state was being threatened by another nation state. Now, it's not so much that the nation state is being threatened, but citizens within the global north or rich citizens in the global south are being threatened by their poor neighbors.
But hasn't there been, Akhil, for a long time, been the idea that, you know, poverty in the global south does pose a security problem for the West before 9/11?
Yes. So in the context of the Cold War, the idea was that poverty in the global south was a problem because poor people were attracted to communism, were more likely to be attracted to communism. And therefore, part of the imperative of foreign aid at the time of the Vietnam War and before, actually right after the start of the Cold War, up to the 1980s, was that we want to have strong efforts to end poverty in the third world, because if we don't do that, then people are likely to turn communist. And if they turn communist, then it'll basically shrink the geographical space and the political space for the West. This was very much the position taken by Robert McNamara, who was the Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War. He stated this explicitly during the Vietnam War, and later on he became the President of the World Bank. And when he became President of the World Bank, he again restated this position. But it was by no means limited to McNamara. All the development intellectuals of that era had the same position.
So now we have these non-state actors, these, you know, they're called terrorists. And so then is the argument today that, well, poverty may not make people more likely to be communist, although that may still be a fear of policymaking elites in the West, but now that poverty in communities could lead people to take actions like those taken by the 9/11 actors?
Yes. So poverty now is seen as a threat for several reasons. One of them is that it can create frustration for people living in various parts of the world. Young people, mostly young men who cannot get jobs, they become political extremists because they are frustrated. They are unable to find employment. They are subjected, because of media, to extremist ideologies that circulate in the global public sphere. And for all those reasons, they are likely to turn to terrorism.
Akhil Gupta is professor of anthropology at UCLA, where he also directs that university's Center for India and South Asia. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Akhil Gupta about poverty, global poverty, human security, and what this focus on the security of elites in the global north means for the prospects for actually addressing and alleviating acute poverty around the world. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Akhil Gupta teaches anthropology at UCLA, and he is co-editor of The Anthropology of the State and of The State in India After Liberalization. We are talking about a very interesting essay he contributed to the volume Territories of Poverty. The volume is edited by Ananya Roy and Emma Shaw Crane. It's published by the University of Georgia Press. And in that volume, Akhil takes up a question which is really the title of his article. It's called, Is Poverty a Global Security Threat? So you were talking about how with this concern about the security now, not necessarily of poor people around the world, according to this discourse at least, but with the security of elites in the global north, in the rich Western countries, that poverty was seen as possibly, potentially, likely turning people who are poor into extremists of some kind, into people who might wreak some kind of havoc on the West. Are there other perceived threats from poverty that, you know, make people in this country, for example, fearful, wary, concerned about their own security?
Yes, actually, what changed was that with globalization came the realization that people were actually closely connected to each other, that there were links that tied people to each other because of interconnected markets and mobility and so forth. So the security discourse and the perception of threats actually increased when globalization was more fully formed, as it were. And there were a range of issues that were seen as threatening the security of elites in the global north. And what were these issues? Things like disease vectors. So the idea that whether it was bird flu or SARS or AIDS, HIV, etc., that they were poor people's diseases that originated in other parts of the world that spread very quickly. And now we are seeing that in the case of the Zika mosquito virus. So disease vectors, in fact, became a much higher concern than they had traditionally been after globalization. Similarly, the danger of biological weapons, bioterrorism, has risen in importance, and you can hear every day discussions about bioterrorism that in some way resemble the discussions that one often found earlier with nuclear terrorism. Then there are other realms such as environmental destruction. So the idea that environmental destruction, the destruction of rainforests in Brazil and Indonesia, were actually threatening the welfare of people in the global north, of elites in the global north, because they were changing not only the world's climate, but they were also changing, you know, available resources, etc. Similarly, there was the idea that dwindling biodiversity in the world might pose the threat because a lot of medicines, etc., were obtained from rainforests, from biodiverse species, etc. And dwindling biodiversity drastically reduced the chance of finding new solutions to various kinds of health risks. And then, of course, there's the ever important and never solved problem of unchecked migration and human trafficking, which has certainly become the hot button issues threatening the security of elites in the global north. In the last few months, especially, you can see this with the refugee crisis in Europe and with the debate over immigration in the presidential campaign in the United States.
So if we return to your point about, you know, human security before 9/11 being really focused on the welfare, the lives and living conditions of acutely poor people around the world, and then that shifts after 9/11, so then human security becomes more focused on the security of elites in the global north, and they're worried about all these problems that you're talking about, disease vectors and terrorism and the like, much of which comes out of poverty or is perceived to come out of conditions of poverty. Well, then, could we say at least that a concern with the security of elites in the global north, that means, okay, well, then poverty needs to be addressed, right? Because if poverty breeds all these things that might harm us or hurt us, then we need to go out there and address poverty on some kind of grand scale, or at least more effectively than we do now. So although the appeal might be self-interested, right, the appeal might not be, hey, we need to help these people because they're suffering, and the appeal is now we need to help these people because otherwise we're under threat, because if we help them, we will be safer. So, you know, maybe the effect is the same, or you tell me, maybe the effect is the same as far as still going out energetically and addressing acute poverty globally.
That's a very good question. And it is possible that one of the effects could be that we need to re-energize in the fight against global poverty. But I think, in fact, the trend has been in a different direction. And the different direction that it has taken is the following, that the idea has been, how do we make ourselves, that is, people in the global north, elites in the global north, more secure against the dangers that are posed by poverty in the global south and poverty at home, right? So, for example, if you were afraid about diseases that might be transmitted by contact, then one way to make yourself safer is to wall yourself in so that you're not in contact with poor people, either migrants or poor people who are part of your own country. Similarly, if the idea is that poverty is a threat because of migration, people, it forces people to migrate and therefore they are in your space, then the solution could be, let's build bigger walls, let's, you know, make sure people can't migrate, let's try to block them, etc. And so this is precisely why the refugee crisis in Europe at the present time is so interesting and so difficult, because it is accompanied by a call to make things harder for the migrants and to prevent them from coming. But it's basically, the idea is that how can we secure ourselves against these people at the same time that there's a recognition that it is poverty, it is war that is forcing people to flee. And there is also a recognition that there is some responsibility. We have a responsibility towards that. And that if people were not poor or they were not insecure, they would not actually leave their homes and come to our space. So there's a paradox there. And that paradox, I would argue, is fundamentally driving what's happening with acute poverty today.
And is it fair to say then that the focus is less on the roots of poverty, the structural inequalities that go along with poverty, and more, as you say, toward how can we protect ourselves from migrants, from disease, etc.?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what has happened. And my argument is that once that shift occurs, then you no longer pay attention to the causes of poverty for the people who are poor. Poverty becomes a problem only because it's inconvenient or it threatens you, the person in the global north who's looking at poor people. And so it changes, it fundamentally changes the morality of the fight against poverty. Why are we interested in fighting poverty? Why are we interested in supporting the poor or helping the poor? Not because their lives are in danger, not because they're dying early, not because they're suffering, but we are doing this because, you know, it helps us feel more secure.
That's the voice of Akhil Gupta. He is professor of anthropology at UCLA. And his books include Red Tape, Bureaucracy, Structural Violence, and Poverty in India. He published an essay in the volume Territories of Poverty, Rethinking North and South, about poverty and security and, to some degree, neoliberalism. That volume, Territories of Poverty, a link to that volume is on our website, againstthegrain.org, as is Akhil's faculty page at UCLA. And I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You, in this essay in Territories of Poverty, you indicate your agreement with what one of the editors of the volume, Ananya Roy, said, which is that poverty is being re-territorialized in the world today. What does that mean?
What that means is that once we start thinking about poverty outside the frame of the nation state, in other words, once we start thinking about something like global poverty, which is poverty that is inherently, we're thinking about something that's a larger space than the nation state, we're thinking about the globe as a whole, then we open up the question about what the relationship is between poverty, say, in the US and poverty in Africa or in India or in other parts of the world. And this is a relationship that has historically been missed in much of the scholarship on poverty. Because if you were a scholar like me who studied the Global South and studied poverty in a country like India, you didn't necessarily make a connection with poverty in the US. So the re-territorialization of poverty refers to two things. It refers, first of all, to the fact that we now have to think about poverty in the global north and poverty in the global south as being in the same frame. And secondly, we have to look at the global processes of inequality that are creating poverty both in the global north and in the global south at the same time. So it's not surprising that you have levels of inequality in the United States today that hark back to the 1920s. Not since the 1920s have we had the levels of inequality that we see in the United States today. And in a country like India, and even in a country like China, you're seeing rising levels of inequality. So in India, especially because we don't have a strongly communist or socialist state that is redistributing resources, you are seeing the rise of large numbers of billionaires. India has more new billionaires than any other country in the world. And at the same time, you see the persistence of acute poverty. And in fact, many people who are, if not absolutely poor, they're relatively poorer than they were before. So the question becomes, how do we think about these relationships? How do we think about the creation of poverty in different parts of the world as being part of the same global process that is also creating higher levels of inequality everywhere?
So would you say you disagree with the rather easy divide often made between global South and global North, right? There's these people in the global South, there's these people in the global North, and there's a kind of a clear line distinction between the two?
Yes. So part of my argument is that we really now need to rethink the categories of global North and global South. So first we started out with the West and the Third World, First World, Second World, Third World, then it was the West and the rest. And now it is global north and global south. But they all basically point to similar divisions, geographical divisions, between those nation states or places that were colonial powers and those that were colonized. And places, if they were not directly colonized, were under indirect rule of various kinds. That geography is no longer analytically very useful when it comes to thinking about poverty in the world today. And the reason is the following, that within the United States today, as I said, because of inequality, there are people who are extremely rich and there are people who are sliding down into poverty from being comfortably middle class. They are now tenuously middle class or they are now lower class. and their wages keep shrinking as a proportion of the total income. In India, similarly, you have growing inequalities and you have a class of people who are rich by global standards. So they're not part of the global south anymore in that sense, because their incomes are as high or higher than most of the people in the global north. And in fact, they are on a par with the extreme, with the 1% in the global north, right? So those people in India who are in that position, those people cannot be conceptualized as somehow living in the global south. Why? Because they can insulate themselves from the living standards and the conditions of the rest of the population. So in South Africa, for example, you have people who live as if they were living in, you know, New York or San Francisco. Their living standards are the same. And then you have people who live in basically shacks made of metal and paper, etc., whose living standards are similar to people in India, right? So what you're seeing is the rise of a global elite in countries like Brazil, Mexico, India, Singapore, and places like that, who are just as rich and living lives that are very similar, that are more similar to the 1% in the global north than to their compatriots. And so what this calls for is a recognition that, in fact, the old geographical divisions between the West and the rest, between the global north and the global south, actually don't tell us what's happening in those places. That, in fact, we need maybe to rethink the way in which we've divided the world geographically. And we need new analytical categories that help us think about what's really going on in the world today.
You referred to rich people in, for example, India or South Africa, insulating themselves from their surroundings, from specifically from poor people. Can you tell us how that plays out in a nation you've been into and you've written a lot about, which is India?
I'll give you a small example. Today in India, you can be the child of a person who is comfortably middle class or upper middle class, and you can grow up in an environment in which you are stepping from an air-conditioned home into an air-conditioned school bus and going to an air-conditioned school and coming back to your house and live in very, very comfortably, travel abroad in your summer vacation, eat at fancy restaurants that are opened by, you know, famous restaurateurs from around the world, etc. And you can lead that life completely cut off from 99% of the population in your own country. And if you go to a rural school, say, even 50 miles away from where this person lives in a big metropolitan center, you can go even 50 miles away and find a child in a rural school who is sitting on the floor in the school, who has never even seen an air conditioner, let alone been in an air conditioned space, who doesn't maybe have electricity at home, who has certainly no running water, no sanitation. The teacher may be absent in school, and so forth. And that kind of division between the conditions under which one small segment of the population lives and the majority of the population in the country lives is something new. It's the result of processes of economic liberalization and neoliberalism. It didn't used to exist before. And so I think rightfully, you could say that this child and these people who represent the 1% in India, they don't really belong to the global south. They belong to a transnational north, in a way.
You know, what you're saying reminds me of what we were talking about earlier with this focus on human security, which after 9/11 changed to the focus on the security, or which meant the security of global northern elites, elites in the global north, and how one responds to that security threat as they perceived it is to, as you were saying earlier about the people in India, these incredibly rich people in India, cutting themselves off from people, sequestering themselves, walling themselves off to the maximum extent possible from poor folks and the perceived threats that poor folks and poor communities present.
Yes. So that is a phenomenon that you find worldwide. It's not just in India. The growth of walled communities, for example, where infrastructure is independent of everybody else's infrastructure. So you have your own generators for electricity. You have your own water supplies. You have perhaps your own sewage treatment plants, etc. And of course, you have barriers to entry into these communities, security guards, heavily policed, militarized zones, enclaves, as it were. And these enclaves are now found all over the world. So whether you're talking about Rio or Sao Paulo, or you're talking about Mumbai or Delhi, you find very similar mechanisms that have come up in different parts of the world that insulate an elite from the rest of the population. And we see similar things happening in the United States as well. So what I'm suggesting is that these are global processes. These are not processes that are limited to one nation state. So if you see this as a global trend and the kind of inequality against which the protests have arisen in the United States, we see that as part of a global trend, then we can see that what's happening, in fact, is a kind of separation between classes of people rather than between nation states from each other.
Akhil Gupta, professor of anthropology at UCLA. You may want to check out his book, Red Tape, Bureaucracy, Structural Violence, and Poverty in India, or his book, Postcolonial Developments, Agriculture and the Making of Modern India. Again, we've been talking about an essay he contributed to the new volume, Territories of Poverty, Rethinking North and South. Akhil, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.
Autonomy is one of the most important of all anarchist principles and a building block for understanding anarchist philosophy more broadly. So what is it exactly? Well, basically, it's freedom. But more than that, it's a particularly anarchist type of freedom. The freedom to make decisions, then act out those decisions without asking permission from a higher power. In some ways, autonomy is similar to liberty, a political concept that dates back to Europe's so-called Age of Enlightenment in the 18th century. Back in those days, liberty was a radical, new idea that sought to put limits on the absolute power of kings and queens. Its early advocates argued that human beings possess certain inalienable rights granted to them by God, which rulers had to respect. This idea was obviously pretty popular, and so it soon became the rallying cry of the French and American revolutions, which helped overthrow feudalism and usher in the era of liberal democracy. Over the centuries, countless astute and not so astute political thinkers, from Voltaire and Thomas Jefferson to Alex Jones and Glenn Beck, have claimed liberty as a universal human right. But to say that this principle hasn't been universally applied would be a gross understatement. This is because from its very beginnings, the concept of liberty has existed within a framework of European global conquest, a process facilitated by colonialism, slavery, and genocide. Even today, the language of liberty is still used to mobilize people's support for imperialist wars. Remember when the United States government claimed they were bringing freedom to Iraq? The roots of this contradiction lie in the fact that liberty has always been tied to the existence of states and the associated legal category of citizens. Often, this is described as a social contract. In exchange for obedience to state authority, citizens are granted rights and freedoms such as freedom of expression, freedom to associate, and the right to pursue happiness or bear arms. Non-citizens or citizens of other states are not included in this contract. And even putting aside the problem of who gets to be considered a citizen, just like anything else that is given to you, rights can also be taken away. At the end of the day, it's politicians and courts who get to decide what rights you are allowed to exercise at any given moment. Autonomy, on the other hand, doesn't rely on a state-based framework of rights. Rather than concentrating power and decision-making in the tops of social and political hierarchies, autonomy starts at the level of the individual and scales up. If you're a visual thinker, it might be helpful to imagine it as sort of like an inverted pyramid. As the scope of autonomy grows to include more and more people, we move from talking about individual autonomy to collective autonomy, the power of groups of people to make collective decisions on issues that affect them directly. Individual and collective autonomy are indivisible under anarchism. You can't have one without the other. Autonomous collectives are made up of autonomous individuals who have all made the decision to work together to pursue their common interests. Unless you're living in a cabin in the woods, it's difficult to exercise individual autonomy outside of a collective. First of all, because those in power make it hard to get away with, and second, because human beings are inherently social creatures. Building collective autonomy is what anarchism is all about. Whether this assumes the form of an autonomous feminist collective that gets together to make decisions on how to fight patriarchy, or neighborhood assemblies that come together to fight gentrification, or even the millions of Kurds in Rojava who are building social structures that are autonomous from the Syrian state. While these are just a few examples, the thing that connects them all is a shared pursuit of greater collective autonomy. And that's something we should all be striving for, because at the end of the day, do you really need someone in authority telling you what you can or can't do? This has been a public service announcement from your friends at submedia.tv.